quick reminder, this is a free event for everyone. So if you do want to become an OFRD member, you can go to the OFRD webpage and join that way, or you're free to just give a donation, because everything we've done to this point, the virtual think tanks, has been free, and that's how we're doing things right now. So with no further ado, I'm Tracy Grissom. I'm your OFRD president. I hope you have a great day with us up until 1:15, and then I hope you can go enjoy the rest of your day, whatever you have planned. We have awesome speakers today. I'm going to turn it over to Jen, and I'm going to let her introduce her whole team of people, because I don't even know everybody she has planned with her, but I know she has some rock stars with her. So Jen, I'm going to let you take it over and give a little welcome to all your speakers. Thank you for being with us today.
Thanks so much, Tracy. For those that don't know me, I'm Jen Walton-Frisette. I'm at Kent State University. And I also want to introduce, but it doesn't really need any introduction, Sue Sutherland from Ohio State University, also past president of OFRD. We've been around quite a bit presenting at OFRD regarding social justice for some time, but I want to say thank you to Tracy, the task force, the executive board, first for making social justice central to the Summer Institute. That was not my wonderful idea, that was theirs. So thank you for the additional work, but for making this really central, it's really significant. We've been feeling that way for many, many years, but it's been at the forefront of many educators over recent months. Those of you that are OFRD members will have received emails from myself along with the executive board regarding a position statement regarding racial injustice. And also more recently, action items that we're tasking to the OFRD board, as well as us as educators. And this is something that we're really committed to working on this year. And one component of that, of course, is providing professional development. And so we're working on that right now. And so Sue and I, of course, in person, have presented quite often at OFRD regarding an array of social justice issues. And this is the first time that we're in this format. Which is unfortunate because we're PE and health and we're very engaging and interactive. And we'll try to do the best that we can during in this format as well. But one of the upsides of that is that we're able to bring to you some of the top scholars in our field here in the United States regarding social justice issues. And so Sue and I will act more as a facilitator today as we allow these speakers to have central focus. But please know across all five of us that we may speak or respond at any time. We've worked together quite a bit, and so we're pretty comfortable in doing that. And so in addition to Sue, I'm pleased to introduce Dylan Landy. Dylan Landy is an assistant professor at University of Towson. I almost said Towson University, I almost said University of Auckland. That is where he obtained his PhD, which is in New Zealand. And Dylan was very privileged to be able to engage with a national curriculum that is really about social critical issues. Which is very different from the US, so he has both of those perspectives. Along with him is Sarah Flory, who's at the University of South Florida. Sarah was a doctoral student at the same time as me and has engaged in a lot of work with myself and Sue Sutherland in a lot of research and presentations as well. Her areas across a wide variety of social justice issues, particularly urban education and more recently LGBTQ+ issues. And so in our first hour today, Dylan and Sarah will really presenting on the social critical model in health and PE. I also want to introduce Michael Hemphill. Michael Hemphill is at the University of North Carolina, Greensboro. He's going to focus during the second part. So when we have that 15-minute break from 10 to 10:15, he'll do this 10:15 to 11 o'clock. And his area really is regarding restorative justice, restorative practice, and has done a lot of work and published in teaching personal social responsibility. He's going to make connections with the restorative justice to racial inequality. And so for many of you, if that's what you're looking for, to get more ideas and understanding about racial justice, he'll be tying that in today. And so as Tracy said, please keep yourselves muted. We're going to ask for your engagement as much as humanly possible. To reduce transition time for us physical educators. We appreciate that. We're not bringing you out into chat rooms and coming back because that would just take away from our time. And so we're really going to ask you to use the, either raise your hand or use the chat box to be able to respond. And because all of our presenters today are wanting to be engaging with you. And we understand that this may be an uncomfortable topic for some of you. It may be new to you. Some of you may feel more comfortable, but this is the space where we're hoping is a brave space that you're able to engage with us during this time. So at this time, I would like to turn it over to Dylan and Sarah. Thank you so much for being here with us.
Tene koto, tene koto, tene koto katoa. Thank you so much, Sue. Thank you so much, Jen, for inviting us here. We are super excited. Main slate for us here is to go over the sociocultural model for the first half. And we're really excited to be virtually here with Ohio AFERD. And I like the fact that you guys are still AFERD. I haven't had that in quite some time. New Jersey just switched over. So I'm really bad at technology, but I'm going to do my best here. So I'm going to share screen. You guys tell me if you're actually seeing what I think I'm supposed to be sharing. Does that look right to y'all? Oh, thank you. So when we talk about the sociocultural model, I want you to think real quick on your own. What is it? What do you think a sociocultural perspective is? And write that like in the chat or think about it on yourself. Go for it. Did I lose everybody? Okay. And if anybody wants to raise their hand, they can go ahead and talk. I don't know how to allow people to talk, so somebody's going to have to do that for me. Yep, so I'm seeing different answers come in that are really good. How you view different cultures, how others view a particular culture, understanding other cultures. Yeah, so socio or social, right, is we're talking about human beings and people, and cultural has to do with the culture. And health and human movement all have to do with social factors and has to do with human movement as well. So what do you think of then when if somebody is being critical toward you, what do you think that means? One answer is judging, looking down on, lacking empathy towards you or your culture. See, a lot of these things are saying harsh, negative, but now let's put that word right in front of another word. What does critical thinking mean? Yeah, so a lot of good answers are coming in. Looking at all different options, decision makings, looking different at, look for different perspectives to make an evaluation to solve something. So when we're talking about being critical, that is sort of what we're talking about. Critical shouldn't be we're judging people or judging cultures or judging the way people are doing things. But critical is, this is the way things have been done. How can we think differently about this so that it's better for everybody involved? So when we think about sociocultural and sociocritical thinking, we're thinking about our own society, our own culture in critical ways in order to make it better. That's the whole point of a sociocultural model. It's we recognize that things are unequal, inequitable, and we want to help people to make their situations better. So what is the purpose of being critical? It's to make things better. You know, when we think about physical education, we think about, you know, you look at your partner and you see how they're doing a particular technique and you want to have them give them feedback so they do it better. Well, we're going to do the same thing, but in relation to sociocultural things, which should be a huge part of physical education and health education. And the reason why it should be is because what we're going to find out over here is that health and physical activity and human movement are all shaped by social things and are all shaped by cultural things. So if we leave them out of a curriculum or of what we're teaching, then we're neglecting roughly 80% of our content. So criticality is when when students question and challenge taken for granted truths or knowledge, and we allow them to undermine what we do. In other words, being critical is thinking about your students as agential, having agency, being able to know what's best in their lives, and giving them the wiggle room or the elbow room to challenge you as the teacher. To do so, we're going to do something called a sociocultural model, and there are three things that are important. The sociocultural model challenges three things. The first thing it challenges is that that there's only personal choice, that we are in charge of everything that we do. The second thing it challenges is that knowledge is fact and that we just should learn these facts over time. And then the third thing that challenges is that knowledge is objective and is separate from our lived experiences. So let's start with the first one, that it departs from personal choice. I want you to think, write it down, anything, just think right now. What is a physical activity, a sport, something that you participate in currently or did participate in when you were younger? And think to yourself, why do you do that? And write it down and like put it right next to your hand here. And we're going to keep coming back to that idea. And while you're doing this, if you feel comfortable, why don't you share what you did in the chat or you can raise your hands. And I'm going to have a sip of coffee. Springboard diving, that is awesome. A reason why people are physically active, it makes them feel confident. Tennis enjoys challenging. Yep. Jen, looks like you have a running partner now. So a lot of reasons why we do things are it makes us feel better. Something I participate in physical activity just about every morning. The reason I do it is because it like gets me focused for the day. I get it out and my endorphins are running and I'm able to think clearly, I'm organized, and it feels good to do it. So I'm gonna swimming full body exercise. I know that's right. So I'm gonna kick it over to Sarah. I know you're over there somewhere in Zoom land. And she's gonna lead you through this next part.
I am over here in Zoom land, and I, forgive me, I have a puppy nearby that's not behaving, so I've tried my best to wrangle him this morning, but he's just a guest, another guest speaker. So when you think about your, that physical activity or that sport that you participated in, You know, there's an interpersonal piece to it. What role did your family play in that? Or did your friends play? I started typing myself that I started playing t-ball and baseball because that's what the kids on the block where I lived, you know, that's what they were doing. And so in order to be involved in that, I kind of took that up too. So what role did your family play in you participating in the sport or physical activity that you did or still do, or your friends? If we want to share some of those in the chat, that would be great too. Can you stop it?
Hi, Kenny Loggins.
My dog's name is Kenny Loggins. That's the entertainment for this morning. So, group exercise class. Yep. Shh, Kenny. Yes. So yes, so we can see that sometimes being physically active is not an option for some folks because it's not supported. Parents encouraged it.
In what ways did your parents encourage it? Transportation, that's a good one.
T-ball, youth soccer, yep. Dad coach swimming, yeah. When your parent is the coach, sometimes you don't have an option, huh? Wow, horseback riding lessons. That sounds amazing. Mm-hmm. Oh, we have a parent that was an aunt was a PE teacher. That's great. Dad told me it would keep me out of trouble. That's amazing. Good. So we see that, yeah, there's a lot of interpersonal reasons that we get involved in some of these activities. Dylan, do you want to add anything before we go to the next slide?
Yeah. So right away, there's this idea that, you know, the reason that we participate in physical activity is because we value it alone and that we enjoy doing it. But in actuality, one of the reasons why we start doing the things that we're doing is because those around us support us to do it, right? So my brother was an amazing wrestler, much better than I was. And I used to go to his wrestling matches. And guess what I wanted to do? I wanted to wrestle. I wanted to be like Jason. And my parents drove me to different matches. And I think about looking back now, how much each of those matches cost tournament-wise. You know, if it's like a $50 entry fee back in the 90s, we won't say what years in the 90s, that wasn't exactly cheap. And without them, I wouldn't have been able to. So right away, yeah, we do participate in physical activity because we enjoy it, because we value it. But there are systems in place that direct us and guide us to what physical activity we can and in some cases, as you saw, cannot participate in. I wanted to play soccer growing up, and my father was like one of those like he-man masculine men. And he's like, my son's not going to be a foot fairy. And I'm like, what? Well, my friends were playing soccer, but that was one way that I was redirected into football based on this idea of what a masculine man is supposed to be. So now that we talked about how our parents and how our friends played a role in it, in what ways did your community, maybe it's your town, right, your city, your school, how did they support you or not support you in participating in the sport or physical activity that you did? There's a good one right away. Neighborhood swimming pool. Yep. Little League, where a lot of parents are running the leagues and they have money. Rec centers. I used to go to the rec center all the time. Summer clinics. Local papers. Oh, that's so cool. Yep.
Yeah. That,
what were you going to say, Sarah?
I was just going to say the local paper we used to, you know, we had, that was like everyone's first job in my town was a paper delivery person, but you could really, you'd get written up in the paper and that was like a big deal. My mom would cut that stuff out and save it. And, you know, back before the internet, I guess I'm showing my age this morning.
We won't talk about that. So we're looking here and it's talking about a lot of the structural things that communities do. They have pools, they have fields, they have parks. They provide the facilities to do it. School sport teams, that's a big one. Think about the amount of money that public schools invest in equipment, in coaching, in all those things, and referees to make that happen, right? And when people leave school, there's a huge drop-off in physical activity, and people are like, well, why aren't people more physically active as they get older? Yeah, part of it's age, but also part of it is that their public institutions are not providing ample support to keep that physical activity up. 80s girl here. I love it. So exactly. These are perfect examples of how our community has these things in place that actually promote us. The thing that I always say is that when I was a kid, the wrestling coach, again, wrestling, used to come down into the elementary schools and recruit all the wrestlers. And I lived in a wrestling town, so it was a big deal. And when you think about how particular towns have particular cultures in place that support particular physical activity and sport, that's another example. We had a really good volleyball program where I'm from. Okay, now think about the institutional things. What are the policies? What are the cultural norms? You know, not just, you know, the school norm of having a good volleyball team, but what are the cultural norms of the state, of the region, that either supported or did not support you in participating in this? Sarah, you take over this one.
So right away, someone in the chat is saying that football is king. And where I grew up, right outside of Detroit and in Michigan, it was football and basketball. That was the only, those were the only two sports that really got a lot of press or support. And I know it's different in different areas. You know, Dylan and I were speaking the other day, and is it lacrosse that's huge in Maryland where you are?
Very big.
Yeah. So you know, you have these specific activities that are sort of privileged over others that definitely have an influence. Or you know, I think some of the other things we were talking about were track. Yes. Yeah. So just based on what you have, what the access is, and what is sort of pushed or encouraged, can really drive. You know, maybe that means that in your school, you only have, you know, a rack of basketballs, and that's the only thing that your school will buy, because that will also, you know, assist with the athletic programs.
Gender specific. That's a good example.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, what gets you status based on, you know, based on what sport you're playing, or if you consider the transgender youth, like what are, what's allowed in your area for students that, you know, don't subscribe to binaries, things like that. The bowling team. I was a bowler. That's a very Midwestern thing, by the way. I live in Florida now, and everyone's like, you were on a bowling league? I'm like, yeah, it snows all winter long. We have to go indoors and do something. Yeah, exactly. So like the status of different teams is really challenged. And, you know, just as we were talking about the, you know, access and, you know, is it available to all students, or is it just certain students can do certain activities?
So, you know, other policies that I think of, Title IX, right? When you think about what Title IX has done to allow people to participate in physical activity, now, you know, somebody said they're pre-Title IX. That's a good example. There are other policies in place that allow and disallow certain people to be physically active, right? Even policies at the state level and the school level and the district level that essentially put money into particular sports and not into others, right? The way that our budgets formulate promote particular types of physical activity. And that ends up getting reproduced over time because it's supported to get reproduced. Homeschool, you were allowed to play sports at our local high school. That's a good example. That wasn't always the case. They used to say that you had to participate in or you had to have like a homeschool league in some places. Mm-hmm. So what's the point here? The point is that we tend to teach Well, physical activity, you have to figure out your own fitness plan. You have to make sure that you're eating the way that you're supposed to eat. You're supposed to be physically active and go out and do things. But in actuality, the overwhelming amount of factors that allow us to be physically active or that promote or not promote physical activity are outside of our control. They're what we call exogenous factors. So health and physical activity are not individual things, but rather they're social things. Things like our age affect us. You know, I have never seen a 75-year-old play tackle football. Probably for good reason. You don't see many ice hockey teams that come from Mexico. Why? Because it's hot there. So even things like geography affect what can and cannot occur in particular areas. Religion. I grew up in a town where all the wrestling tournaments were on Saturday and we had a high Jewish population. So could they participate in physical activity? Absolutely not. Particular cultures value physical activity in different ways, right? So when you think about how, you know, in Italy, what we call soccer, football is huge, right? When you go to New Zealand, rugby is huge. When you go to different parts of the United States, right? If you're in inner city Philadelphia, basketball is huge. You know, you have to think about where you are and how that place affects what can and cannot happen. But importantly, you have to allow your students the chance to evaluate those things as well. So just like we're going through this with you, if you're teaching a particular physical activity or sport or anything, these are the types of things that have to be discussed with your students as well. How are you going to be able to do this or not going to be able to do this? What are the factors involved with this? So first thing we want to depart from is that personal choice is the driver of physical activity. Actually, no. We know this from countless studies. It's something like 77% of like health is assembled or is based on exogenous factors, right? So 3/4 of our health is dependent on things that are outside of our control. So rather than just saying, well, you need to do it and you need to go out and you need to do that, we should actually be saying, okay, well, what are some of the benefits? What are some of the limitations? What are the things that affect this? The second thing is that knowledge is socially constructed. It's not necessarily a fact, but rather it's something that's malleable. It's constantly changing. And when you look at a textbook from 1950 to now, you obviously know that to be the truth. So what do we mean by social construction? Sarah, you want to take the lead here?
Sure. So again, knowledge is socially constructed and culturally produced through relationships and again, through an active manner. It's not natural. Like all of this knowledge is influenced by all of the different factors from that last slide, all of the different influences that have an effect on us every day. So there are certain forms of knowledge that are socially produced that, you know, they influence us in different ways because of how they are sort of accepted or more or less accepted within our little realm that we live within. Just like, you know, it's believed that football is more important or very important in certain states, or basketball is important, or being a particular type of masculine is very important for certain folks. Those are all social constructions and are important to consider when we're, you know, planning with our students, when we're teaching. Every little thing that we do comes down to some of these factors that that shape how we do things.
So when we're thinking about knowledge as socially constructed, if we're teaching driver's ed, which I used to do, if I say you come up to a light and it's red, what do? You stop. Is there anything natural about the color red that forces people to stop? No, it's something that we've created as a culture, a sign, a symbol, in order for us to understand the roads and the way that we navigate those roads. The same thing is true for physical activity and health. There's no such thing as protein, right? that's a word that we ascribe to something that we're trying to figure out. And what we know about protein is constantly changing over the years. You know, think about how diet numbers have changed from, you know, I grew up on the food pyramid. Now it's the food plate. And before that, it was something else. I remember watching this thing around milk and how it was the greatest thing in the world at one point, and then it wasn't. What we know about these things are constantly changing. And that's the same for human movement. If we think about this, right, if these social constructions are things that we create to make sense of our world, we have social constructions in health and PE. For example, basketball. There's nothing natural about 5-on-5. It's just a rule that we created. And one of the models that has done a great job of questioning these social constructions is TGFU, or tactical games, or teaching games for understanding. What they do is they say, well, actually, no, that's socially constructed. Let's change the court size. Let's change the rules. Let's change how things are going in this space in order to make people think differently. When we think about health and physical education, and we think about who it has been constructed for over the years, people who look like me predominantly, then we realize that the social construction of physical education has been created to benefit people like me. So how can we change those social constructions so that it makes things more equal? That's the question that drives us. So, since we're on it, what are some examples of things that are socially constructed in physical education? What are things that we come up with that aren't necessarily natural things, but they help us explain the world or physical activity to our students? And it's okay to be wrong about this. I always screw things up. When I was in high school, I had a history teacher who said, there's no such thing as stupid questions, just stupid people. I didn't ask any questions anymore after that. So, yeah, teams, how we create teams, the rules of particular games, those are all socially created and can change. What else? How we use the equipment and what we use the equipment for, exactly. Yeah, the dimensions of a playing field can change, exactly. Gender, understanding what gender is socially constructed. Right. The best example I always give about this is if I'm going to describe something real quickly, and everybody tell me if you think it's a woman or a man. I am a person who's wearing heels, stockings, a wig, makeup, frilly clothing. Am I a guy or a girl? Bingo, somebody wrote Hamilton, George Washington. See, these things change over time, so they're socially constructed. Good job, whoever got that. But the point is that our understanding of masculinities and femininities are socially constructed. But the problem is that those social constructions have the ability to turn into ideologies or discourses that shape our lives. If men are only expected to act a certain way and women are only expected to act a certain way, that limits what we can do. If during a game, we are limiting what students can do in physical activity, then what we're doing is we're saying, this is the only way that you can do this. And we're imparting our cultural norms onto students who may want to do something different. Think about the amount of times that I can think of where we were teaching something and the kids were like, oh, I don't want to do this, but it's in the curriculum. You know, the reason they don't want to do it is because it's not connected to their own lives and their social and their worlds. So when we allow these discourses to drive what we do, it's problematic. So what are some discourses here? Well, we have discourses around gender. We have discourses around race. We have discourses around sexuality, right? The example is real men play rugby. In New Zealand, you don't play American football because only girls wear pads. That's what they say, right? It splits things up by gender and masculinity and femininity. And what that does is it limits what people can do. So when we think about that, if knowledge is considered fact and not socially constructed, we should be asking who benefits from these facts. Who benefits from race being understood in a particular way? Who benefits from imparting particular religious values over other ones? Who benefits when social class plays a role in this? We have to think about these things and get students to think about these things. So, the goal is not to create skilled performers. It's not to create health experts. It's about using movement to problematize the assumed right way of doing things. So in health, it's about, you know, questioning taking for granted norms like fat people are lazy. Instead of trying to reproduce old knowledge, the goal is to create new knowledge that connects to young people's lives, which is where we are going to go with Sarah. So just as a recap, knowledge are not facts to be memorized and regurgitated, but rather it's constantly changing. And because it's changing, we have to allow students the ability to change it themselves. All you, Sarah.
Awesome. Just needed to unmute myself again. So the next concept or principle is to really focus on making things student-centered. And again, if we need to or want to create new knowledge, you know, we can just tell students the right way or the correct knowledge to do or to believe or to act upon. But it's much more student-centered if we have the students become the center of knowledge that they produce. That can be anything from having students sort of help create the community in your classroom or in your gym by, you know, assisting with the syllabus or, you know, creating norms for the classroom that everyone can agree upon. But it also helps the students make those things that much more meaningful because it connects to what they've experienced, what they've lived, rather than just, I just do this because the teacher tells me. Empowering students to be more, you know, in charge of their own learning can really be effective in helping center their experiences and, you know, having them buy into what is happening within your class. Sorry, I have to move the chat box here again.
No, you're good.
Yes. So linking that content to personal lives, you know, applying, having students make that connection immediately to what has happened in their own lives. And this can happen at the elementary level all the way up to the secondary level. Again, and using those questions of, you know, what does this knowledge privilege and what does this mean? And is this for everyone or just for certain groups? We can, you know, ask them to challenge their own thinking and to be more critical of the things that we sort of take for granted. They can do this through, you know, journals, scrapbooks, collages, interviewing other folks in their, you know, in their homes or in their classes, and really make that connection between what's happening in your class and their where they spend the rest of their time.
So something that I used to do with my seventh graders is we used to have we used to choose physical activities that the students wanted to participate in. So what are things that you're interested in? Okay, cool. A, you're going to teach that to the rest of your class, whatever it could be, right? So they would take the reins and they would teach those physical activities. B, they would interview their community and their family and their friends about how they can and cannot participate in this physical activity when they leave school. So they would go to their parents, they would go to their aunts, they would go to their uncles. I'm moving and that just something fell. So, and all these different things, they would go through the interviews. Then what they would do is they would collate these interviews and they'd turn it into a presentation for the entire class. We taught this to you. These are the people who get to participate in this. These are the people who don't get to participate in this. And these are the reasons why. Then they took that same presentation and they got feedback from their class. Did you consider this? Did you consider that? And then they presented it to our town council. And our town council would look at it and say, huh, what are some things that we can do in our community to allow these kids to participate in something that they want to do? And one of the things that ended up happening as a result to this was they put in a skateboard park. That's an example of culturally embedded practices. The students in that town wanted to do a particular physical activity. They taught it to each other. They then went and they spoke to their parents. What were reasons that you did this or didn't do this? Some had to do with finances. Some had to do with space. And most of that was the biggest issue with space in this place. And then they brought that to their class and their class questioned it. And then they presented it to their town, all part of a physical education class. So what does this mean? It means that you have to have whatever you're teaching about. It could be about gender. It could be about football. It could be about anything. It has to connect back to their community and it has to connect back to their life. They have to examine the way that they've been able to participate in these things and not been able to participate in these things. You have to give them the opportunity to talk about the culture that they are a part of. What are the physical activities that they want to do? You know, something that kids just don't want to do anymore, you know, from my experience, has been like baseball or softball because they have a hard time playing it. They have to find a minimum number of people. They have to find a field. And they have to find, you know, somewhere to go, essentially, and have the equipment. But some of my kids love parkour, and we taught that. Well, I didn't. They did, because I would fall, and everybody would laugh at me. So we discussed that, and we discuss how, you know, even the physical activities that they're participating in and that they're teaching, how those things are structured by gender, how they're structured by race, how they're structured by social class. And it would make the people presenting those physical activities think, wow, I've been privileged that I've been able to do this, but this hasn't been accessible to everybody else. Like we said, physical activity is mostly social. So what we're saying here is that, you know, anybody here ever heard the whole the old adage that knowledge is power? Just raise your hand. What we're arguing here is actually no, power equals knowledge. And people who are in power get to put particular knowledge onto other people. And if we care about culture and if we care about youth, by giving them the power, then they can set the course of the new knowledge. Instead of a curriculum department saying you need to teach football, you need to teach basketball, you need to teach these skills, have the students talk about what they want to do. Because at the end of the day, if the goal is to value the physically active life, then it has to be valued by the people that it's centered around, not by somebody who is 100 to 1,000 to 3,000 miles away. Sarah, anything you want to add there?
I think you nailed it, Dylan.
I always think of the hammer that comes down when somebody says that.
Nailed it.
So, Jen, why don't you tell us where to go from here? Do we want to do questions, answers, hugs?
How about we take questions from the audience that they have for both of you or any of us that want to chime in? And while you're asking these questions, I guess my one question to all of you will be, what are some ways, as you've gone through this presentation by Dylan and Sarah, have you thought about how you can teach about and for the social critical model in your health and PE programs? Have you thought of ways that you can either teach this content to the students, or different ways that you can present information, or different ways that you can set up your environment and your rules, routines, expectations, or your curriculum, et cetera? So that's my big picture question for you to think about. And you might need more time than just the next few minutes to be able to think about that, because that's really, you know, big. And those of us that are do the work in social justice, this is what we're doing all the time. Our work is constantly changing because of this. So let's take questions from all of you. And then if we have a couple of minutes left, we can engage in the question that I just posed.
Just to add to what Jen said, not only think about information that you can take from this presentation, which was fabulous, by the way, Sarah and Dylan, thank you. But so things that you might already be doing that would align with this, that you could share with the group. Because, you know, the more people that share, the more knowledge we have. And you can use the chat if you don't want to jump on verbally. You can post a question in the chat, or you can just raise a hand, or just wave and we'll try and find you.
I'm going to speak out loud. I think Heather is only privately messaging me. So her question is, what can I say if a student, fifth grade, says volleyball is for girls?
Do you want to take this, Sarah?
Sure. That's early to be feeling so gendered about a particular sport. And I think we can always provide examples. It's very interesting. I've had students here in Florida that have played, like some schools have men's volleyball teams. And I know in California, that's also very big. So I always try to provide examples that particular sports and particular activities are not gendered whatsoever. And that, yes, also dance, yes. That, you know, when we as the teachers set the example that, you know, these activities are not for particular types of people, that physical activity and physical education is for everybody, everyone. But we just sometimes have to find ways to make that so if policies and whatnot dictate otherwise. If we start that kind of message young, we can kind of outdo that. A good friend of mine was an elementary physical education teacher and had a jump rope club, an after-school jump rope club. And at first it was, you know, had maybe two or three boys in the club, and had a lot of parents that were very concerned, like, oh, I don't want my kid to be in a jump rope club. That's a girly thing. And by the time that she left that school, she had an equal number of boys and girls in this jump rope club, because she made sure to not gender it and to not, to identify like all of the athleticism and all of the benefits of being, you know, great at jumping rope and doing all the, I mean, I hit my shins every time I do jump rope type things, but.
You need a longer rope.
I probably do. And I need to keep my U instead of the I. I'm remembering my Q's there.
Yeah.
But I think just kind of challenging those and asking, I mean, I know it's hard as a elementary student to say, well, why do you think that way? Because I'm sure they're hearing it from other places.
So
go ahead, Dylan. Yeah. Jump in.
I'm a guy, so I have particular sort of ways of doing things. So me, I challenge gender binaries. Like if somebody said volleyball's for girl, I go, oh, I must be a girl, 'cause I play volleyball. And they look at me like, you're not a girl. And I'm like, well, if only volleyball players are girls, then I have to be a girl because I play volleyball. Right? If you challenge the norms yourself, it really throws them off. Another thing that people do is they have examples of excellent volleyball players who are guys from their state. They're like, look at this Olympian volleyball player, and it's this person. Oh, okay. So you don't have to be a girl. You can be a guy. And actually, a lot of guys play it. And when you go to the beach, a lot of guys play it, right? So the reason why people have these beliefs, right, especially at a young age, is because it's all they've been exposed to in many cases. So by challenging that and doing those things, another example, you know, that we always come up with is dance. Everybody's like, well, I don't want to dance. You dance with, like, dance with a girl. And then something that we do as physical educators a lot of time is we pair up boys and girls. First of all, just let them dance with whoever they want to dance with, right? And talk about, yeah, I went dancing the other night with my friends, and I danced with guys, I danced with girls. And you talk about how, you know, dancing is a huge part of your culture. I worked in a predominantly Spanish district. And when they were young, there was no issues with gender around dancing. As they got to middle school, it was a larger issue, but then something that worked for me was, I go, well, think about, you know, your particular different cultures. I had a large group of students from the Dominican Republic, the DR. I'm like, do men dance in the DR? They're like, well, yeah, all the time, because dancing is a huge part of Latina culture and Latino culture. So what they were able to do was like, oh, wait, it isn't as gendered as we think it is, and we can do this, and they do. And they bring their own music in a lot of cases, and they do that. For the girl push-ups, I used to do girl push-ups, so that must make me a girl as well. So these are just things that we say, right? And when we challenge those things that we say, and we say, you know, I know boys who do girl push-ups, and I knew girls who do push-ups, more push-ups than men. Actually, the record at my elementary school was by a girl. So it's about providing different examples. Yeah, Sue.
Dylan, Brian wanted to jump in, I believe, on something around girls' push-ups.
Yeah.
All right, how's it going? So when I'm retired from the Army, and when I was in the Army, it was always called a girl push-up. When I went to college to become a physical educator, it was drilled in our head, the social constructs of it, and to get rid of it. So what I do is I create levels of everything. So level one would be just a plank. Level two would be the modified push-up, and I eliminate the vocabulary right off the bat.
Good.
With my students. And then level three is regular push-ups, and sometimes I call it beast mode. I'll give them a challenge and say, okay, if you're going to make it into beast mode today before we leave, you need to do, depending on, you know, their age and stuff like that, it could be 10, it could be 15, it could be 20. And in just 1 year at the school that I started at last year, I've noticed that vocabulary start to change with those students just by eliminating it from never saying it myself. And maybe that's something that you all could incorporate, is by breaking it into levels and having three options. Because as muscle fatigue occurs, you may have to go down a level or you may go up a level. It just depends on how you're doing that day.
And that's the other thing I was about to say, you know, and talk about how it's okay to go up and down between levels, right? A level does not necessarily mean better. It just means at that point in time, this is where you are, and sort of going through. That's a great, great, great way of doing it. Nice job. Somebody else is raising their hand.
We have to unmute her somehow. Hang on.
If you're asking me to do technology, we're all screwed.
I think it was Betty Kern. Can Jen or Sue, can you unmute?
I can't. So Tracy, can you unmute Betty, please?
Sure.
We're working on it. Hang in then, Betty.
Well, while we're getting Betty on board here, there was a teacher in New Zealand. His name was Dan. He used to. So in New Zealand, there's something called netball, which is like similar to basketball, but not similar to basketball. There's no backboard, and like you have to have like X amount of space. But it's a very gendered game, and you essentially you're expected to wear skirts. And this male phys ed teacher, whenever he did the netball unit, he used to go and wear the netball skirts for the entire unit to sort of challenge the idea that netball is only for girls. And then he talked about how he played it with others. Did we get Betty on board? No?
Not yet. We've tried unmuting you on this end, Betty. Do you have anything?
That's how I feel with life.
Can you type it in the chat? Or is it too long?
Brian says they should be able to unmute themselves. So if you move the cursor to the bottom left corner, Betty, and you click on the mute button or unmute.
Looks like that's a no-go for unmuting right now.
Yeah.
Betty, if you want to type it, we can definitely share.
While she types it so that you can share, we're going to be wrapping up our first hour already. You know, however, of course, we can bring in some questions, especially during the break. If you think of questions, you certainly can bring that up into our other presentation that Michael will be doing. And since we already did an introduction, we'll really just get right into things at 10:15. And he's also going to connect to what Sarah and Dylan just presented as well. And just so that you know, obviously you can reach out to our colleagues if you want us to share their contact information. I'm sure they'd be fine with that. And then Sue and I, of course, are here in Ohio that are always willing to provide support when it comes to any social justice and equity issues. Betty, were you able to type it in or do you want to carry it on over? I think that this is really nice, that especially we've come up with so many examples that are about gender. And some in the chat, I don't know how many people are following in the chat, can really intersect gender with race. Mm. And that'll tie in very nicely with what Michael will be presenting in the second half.
And I just want to reiterate what Antoinette Brown had put in the chat, that we have to pay attention to our own bias, absolutely. And I think we'll get more into that either next session or in some of the answers. But yes, you've got five people here who wholeheartedly agree with you.
Yeah, we all have biases. And, you know, I'm really glad I have colleagues that I work with who we all trust each other enough where we're like, did you think about this? And I'm like, no, I didn't. I'm sorry. I need to rethink that. And I come back to the drawing table. So it's about having people that you can trust to challenge you on those things as well. And we're biased because we have different experiences. Oh, hi, somebody's here.
That's why I have Sue.
Yeah.
Well, vice versa, Jen.
So my best friend that I work with, her name's Tara Blackshear, right? And Dr. B is a Black woman who grew up at a different time than I did, right? So we have different age groups and we have different races and we have different genders. And the way that we've experienced the world is very different. So when I say something, she goes, yeah, that may be true for, you know, a white guy, but it's not necessarily true for a Black woman. And I'm like, okay, I need to rethink this. And she challenges me and I'm comfortable with her challenging me. That's part of it, is knowing that, you know, we're gonna screw up and it's okay to screw up, revel in that screwing up.
Okay, folks.
Go ahead, Sue.
I was just going to say it's 2 minutes past 10. So thank you to Dylan and Sarah for a fabulous presentation. Thank you very much. We'll do some sign language there. So you now have a 13-minute break, soon to be down to 12, before we go into Michael's session that's talking about restorative practice, restorative justice. And let me tell you that if you thought the first one was fabulous, the second one's going to be equally so. So please rejoin us. We've got some great content coming up and some great discussion. So have a break, go to the loo or restroom, bit of cultural there. And we will see you at 10:15. Thank you.
Welcome back, everyone. I know that it might take a minute or two for some people to get back since we cut into that 15-minute segment. However, I want to give Michael as much time as possible since this is only a 45-minute presentation. Just a reminder that this is the physical education breakout session, that the social justice topic will continue from 11:15 to 12 o'clock will be a health education breakout session with Scott Todd-Nem. And then we'll be closing from 12:30 to 1:15 for advocating for quality health education and physical education in Ohio. So just to know that those still are in the social justice track. For right now, I'm gonna turn it over to Michael Hemphill. His presentation is titled, as you see it up here, Toward a Restorative Physical Education, Pedagogical Stances for the Era of Black Lives Matter. Michael, thank you so much.
Thanks, Jen. It's good to be here with you virtually. And I'm here in Greensboro, North Carolina. It is high 80s this morning. We're gonna top off in the around 93 degrees, and we get high humidity here in the South. So that makes me wish I was physically with you in Ohio, where it might be a bit cooler, although still summer July heat. This presentation hopes to build on the last one and build on some of the momentum we've seen this summer that's shifted the way we think about education, what I call in that subtitle, the era of Black Lives Matter. We're going to use the chat box, just like last session seemed to go really well, and to kind of help warm things up and just assure me that the technology is indeed working appropriately. I'll invite a few comments in the chat box now on how has this movement of Black Lives Matter impacted the way you're approaching education as we re-enter schools this fall. And I know we may re-enter physically or virtually. So if I see two or three comments on how Black Lives Matter shapes the way you approach your schools in the fall, that's going to cue me that you can hear me, you can see me, and you can see my slides, and I'll move into the presentation today. As I await those, I'll share this presentation is in part going to lay out how the Black Lives Matter movement is shaping my approach to my university setting, but more importantly to K-12 physical education. For the past 3 years, I've led a ninth grade physical education program on Tuesdays and Thursdays with help of a doctoral student. And so that's really shaping what I'm presenting to educators today. So I appreciate Dylan for helping me frame that, and he's thinking about what's going on in Baltimore, Maryland, and how racial justice is inclusive of physical health, physical activity in education. So I would like to build on that, and in addition to that, commend Ohio AFERD for its clear, powerful statement around the events that transpired this summer. In that statement, they are suggesting that we can actually engage in a collective effort to give our students voice. We can review our curricula and our pedagogy to make it more inclusive and promote equity. However, in addition to that, the statement was followed up by what I would call pedagogical stances, suggesting that there are specific things we can do to move toward equity in our education. I really want to build on this in my presentation today. And this statement is in fact something that I will use to reflect on my own teaching here in Greensboro, North Carolina. So how can we, as the last bullet point illustrates, offer pedagogical and learning experiences that are devoid of perpetuating gender binaries and racial injustices? So thank you for joining me and thinking about that today. For me, I've used restorative justice as a framework for teaching physical education and trying to educate myself about these issues of race and equity and how I can engage with the diverse cultures that are presented to me and the students I encounter at my university and at the high school that I'll be talking about today. I'm not gonna have time to go super in depth on restorative justice, but I will give a bit of framing so that we can engage in pedagogical stances in a restorative context. So briefly, restorative justice is based on three pillars that suggest that our students and any members of community experience harms. And that could be from interpersonal harms, such as bullying in schools, or it could be from structural harms, such as food insecurities in communities. So those harms create needs, and those needs need to be addressed. And so communities are obligated to address the needs of its citizens, of its students, right? And so restorative justice is about owning those obligations and saying those are in fact our obligations as a collective community. And therefore it requires some continuous engagement that acknowledges the harms that have been experienced, challenges the structural issues that might lead to those harms, and tries to meet the needs of all students, offenders and victims, not only punish those who might have committed wrongdoing. A restorative justice scholar recently said the best definition she had heard of restorative justice was this 12th grade student's explanation of it reported in Masha Wynn's textbook. And she talks about restorative justice being like restoring an issue where there's justice on both sides. So I mentioned the offender and the victim. And they come to an agreement, and that's where or how justice is going to happen. So there's some inclusivity in this process. In schools, restorative justice, are often called restorative practices, has kind of been generalized across these three levels, the bottom of the triangle being the kind of the widest spread of restorative justice, those things that can be seen universally across a whole school context. So integrating social emotional learning skills throughout the curriculum, but also thinking about learning spaces, hallways, and other practices that happen universally in a school. But it also recognizes that there has to be targeted, intentional, pedagogical practices that recognize that harm occurs and therefore nurtures students and makes effort toward repairing relationships that have been impacted by various harms or meeting the needs of our students. And then finally, at the top tier, perhaps not necessary for every student, but equally important, is there needs to be processes for responding to significant harms. In schools, this could be, you know, a big fight happens, and there needs to be a process to address that, that promotes justice on both sides and provides processes for students to return to the school environment without that event reshaping their meaning of personhood in that particular community. With the focus on conflict, I found that perhaps this is an overgeneralization, but you can place the types of conflicts we're seeing into three buckets presented here. In the first one, there's conflicts that students navigate themselves. This often happens in spaces such as social media, on school buses, hallways, locker rooms, places where adults are not necessarily monitoring or enforcing rules. These conflicts can escalate, and when they do, they show up in our classrooms, and teachers have to manage those conflicts. And so we can think about as teachers, what's in our toolbox to address conflicts in a way that's restorative or in a way that's punitive. But we know that if those conflicts are not dealt with effectively, they continue to escalate and end up in a central office with an administrator who also has a toolkit that he or she can use that may be restorative or punitive. One thing that is clear from education literature is that as conflicts reach this third level and principals dole out of school suspensions, students are less likely to drop out of school, or are more likely to drop out of school, excuse me, and they're more likely to end up in the criminal justice system, leading to a school to prison nexus or school to prison pipeline. This is experienced disproportionately among minority students, creating an issue for race equity. Therefore, as this applies to restorative justice in schools, the most common, not the only pedagogical tool of restorative justice, but the most common tool and the one that I'll mention today is the restorative circle process. We use proactive circles as a tool to teach social and emotional learning skills, including conflict resolution, in ways that would give students a toolbox such that they can navigate issues that they're experiencing in their own lives, in their own spaces that they navigate on their own, such as social media, as mentioned previously. We also want to provide teachers with tools through reactive circle processes, to address harms that become present in their classrooms. And if I didn't mention earlier, the basic idea of circles is to give all students a voice in whatever the content of a circle may be. In this issue of harm, it could be a circle process to give all students a voice in rulemaking. Okay, so in fact, in the program that I teach, we begin every semester with circle processes to create what we call norms. And I explain to the students what my needs are, and they explain to me what their needs are. As a teacher of that program, particularly not employed by the school, I'm an outsider, I need for there to be some semblance of order in the classroom, because if school officials come by and see me teaching a class that's not appropriate, where there's a lot of disorder, then I'm no longer gonna be invited to the school. So the students understand that that's a need of mine that has to be met, and we can negotiate rules around my needs and around their needs. And then finally, I won't talk much about this today, but at this next level, the restorative conference is an intensive process that does require significant amounts of training, but it's a tool that principals can use as an alternative to school suspension. So if you take one thing from circles and decide to try it or not, one thing we have to realize is that the proactive part is very important for there to be any positive impact from the reactive part of restorative justice. Imagine a conversation that we might have today. If I ask you right now to type into the chat box and tell me what your favorite something is, your favorite color, your favorite food, your favorite physical activity, you'll be readily able to present that. You'll be excited to present that, perhaps. In fact, we learned something about some sports you enjoyed in the last conversation. That can help build an understanding of where we're coming from, help build some trust to get to different types of questions. However, if I ask you right now to explain to me, what is your position on this issue of should athletes kneel or stand for the national anthem, and explain your position? We have not built the level of trust and understanding among this community to have that conversation yet. It's striking to me that when I hear high school athletes talk about that same question, it seems apparent that they've not had the initial relational conversations that allow them to have a deeper conversation about the protest that's occurring. For example, we hear one side speak to issues of Black Lives Matter and the other side speak to issues of a love for patriotism and respect of military, two issues that are not necessarily in conflict if they're discussed at length, but would appear to be in conflict if they're discussed among an audience that does not have any common understanding of or trust for where one is coming from. So the circle process for me and in restorative justice is a space to build toward that common understanding and to reach more unified conclusions. So with all that said, I'm gonna pivot. And so I wanna stop and ask a question. Restorative justice is trendy right now, and it's happening in a lot of places. Perhaps it's happening in your community and in different ways. So I wanna know from you, your opinion, does it work? And in your answer, you can just give me a yes, a maybe, or a no, and feel free to add a sentence or two to that. There's no right or wrong answer, as Dylan shared earlier, but what do you think? Does it work? Based on what you know so far. And I have my chat box up, so I'm gonna pause just for a moment to give a few people a chance to chime in, and then I'll move on from there. If facilitated and well and student-centered, thank you. Yes, some not sure, there's some uncertainty, don't think it will work. These are common kind of answers that I see if parties can reach the place of trust. So let me get, no matter what you're thinking, some have seen it done, haven't seen it done well. So everybody is right here. This is one of those presentations where everybody's gonna walk away feeling good and you had the right answers. So we see this kind of response in the literature. There's some evidence that it can work. There's a randomized controlled trial where suspensions were reduced significantly. That was true in low-income communities and among Black students. So that was really promising. We also see issues where this kind of colorblind approach actually shows some improvements on the margins, but it fails to address structural issues that lead to inequitable discipline outcomes. So maybe we slightly reduce suspensions, but we're still suspending our minority students at a much higher rate. So we haven't got at the root cause. Yet still there are some studies, and I sense some skepticism from respondees that these may be implemented in ways that just are not sustainable. And there's evidence of that in the literature as well. So what do we make of this mixed bag, and why would we even, you know, move forward? What I want to suggest today and for the remainder of the presentation is that restorative justice is about changing paradigms. And a lot of times people adopt it as changing practices. Okay, adding circle processes to a school that has punitive discipline practices without changing your approach to discipline will reproduce those same discipline practices. This is the same for other models that come into favor in education. And so we need to think about how do we get into a mindset space to shift paradigms for restorative justice. I'm going to suggest that pedagogical stances can guide this process and offer four of them here. I'm going to ask if you would use the chat box to indicate if there are ways that these pedagogical stances can inform your teaching at your school in Ohio. So thinking very locally here. In return, I'm going to share how these pedagogical stances have influenced my physical education program at James B. Dudley High School in Greensboro, North Carolina. The first pedagogical stance is the idea that history matters. So we must seek out histories that make us uncomfortable, right? So think for a moment, and again, use the chat box if you can share a couple of examples of histories that would inform the way you teach in Ohio, the way you teach in your specific community in Ohio. Are there certain events that are necessary to understand your students, your school, or your community? Are there histories that shape the power dynamics of your school or community that you need to understand? And then what personal, professional histories shape your understanding of students and their communities? And so to keep things moving, the way I'm going to use this segment is as I see one or two comments in the chat box, I'm going to move to my reporting out here. So I'm going to pause to look for a comment or two. Good. So Black History Month, and thinking about how that applies to your specific community. As I'm presenting, if you have thoughts, go ahead and put them in there. I don't feel like it's disruptive, but I'll keep moving to keep us on time. So yeah, having students share their history and how it shapes them. So for me, what I did, and I teach this to my students who assist me in the school, we looked at some things that are happening in our community. We find that the community leads the nation in eviction rates. It's situated in a food desert. It is a segregated school that started as a segregated school only for African Americans and remains, you know, over 90% Black today. The community around it experiences social unrest, and this unrest, violence, drugs, et cetera, is consistent with conditions of concentrated poverty. So this history helps me understand why we see certain things happening in the school, such as why do we have the highest rate of absenteeism in the school district. Well, if students are being evicted from their homes, that helps me understand that. How can that inform my pedagogy? Additionally, however, we see history that uplifts. We see alumni of the school becoming the first Black doctor to work in the local hospital. We see the first Black lawyers to pass the bar exam in North Carolina, the first Black judge on the North Carolina Supreme Court among the alumni. This can give a narrative to students of success to counter the narratives that our community creates around these more deficit-oriented perspectives that the students are dealing with. We also find great pride in the success in athletics among its alumni and a long history of peaceful protests, including its students being on the front lines of the 1960s sit-in protests that were the impetus for the civil rights movements in the 60s. And a current protest of mass incarceration today, where students wear prison uniforms to make folks feel uncomfortable about that issue. So that can inform my pedagogy and my stances. I need to know that. The second pedagogical stance is that race matters. Okay, so we have to consider the role of racism and racist ideas in how we think about students as learners. Again, the chat box is open for you to think about and share your perspective on how does race matter in your pedagogy. What are our perceptions of students based on their race? What do their families value? What do they value? And how has race shaped the experiences of students in our school? And this is contrary to kind of a colorblind approach where we say, you know, we want to teach all students are the same. And certainly this overlaps with history some. When we looked at race matters, here's what position pedagogical stance it offered us. It offered us an understanding, again, of what's happening in schools. We see a school district where African Americans are 40% of the enrollment, but make up 74% of out-of-school suspensions, short-term suspensions, that is. So that's problematic in terms of race equity in and of itself. But when looking deeper and saying, why is this happening? Why are we seeing inequitable outcomes among races? We see issues that are tied up in race and culture, dress code violations, disrespect, truancy, things that we can't separate from issues of race. Okay, if administrators are mostly white, what position are they in to judge what it means to be respectful in different cultures? So these are the types of questions that these pedagogical stances can empower us to ask. Furthermore, we look at how historical trends on race explain this race inequity. And we find that in the 1960s, African-American educators and administrators were erased from North Carolina schools. And so this helps us understand that how can we build a system that processes Black students out at this efficient rate? Well, you can understand it better when we understand that their caretakers were taken out of that system when that system was built and developed. And so by taking that pedagogical stance, I understand that this is problematic and has to inform my pedagogy and approach to these students. Even if it's as simple as, if a student shows up to our program with a dress code violation, how am I gonna address that? How do I respond? Certainly, it's gonna be different knowing this information than it would be prior to that. The third of four pedagogical stances that I offer is justice matters. So educators must be guided by a moral compass, insisting we do right by people. And the chat box is open here, and I do see comments have continued to flow in and appreciate that around these pedagogical stances. So what is this idea of justice? What does it mean to you, and what does it look like in schools? And certainly when I'm talking about justice, I'm thinking about issues of fairness and equity, not issues of punishment in a criminal justice system. what normative stances do we adopt that undermine justice? For example, I mentioned the dress code issue. I could take the normative stance that the dress code is a rule, is a school rule. And therefore, if a student shows up to my class with a dress code violation, they have broken that rule and they will be punished according to the school rules. Or I can say that I've seen the racial inequity in the way those punishments are carried out. And so I'm going to approach this differently because justice matters. Again, thinking locally here, which I'm going to encourage you to do, we examined a Supreme Court ruling, North Carolina Supreme Court ruling by Leandro that found over 25 years, the state of North Carolina failed to provide a sound basic education. Black students were routinely funneled to remedial programs and away from academically gifted programs. And this complemented national policies that funneled resources away from low-income communities. So this injustice positions me differently in how I approach my students, because I know that a Supreme Court has said we failed to provide them with a sound basic education. And so therefore, we speak to our students in restorative justice circles about questions like, what is owed to you as a citizen of this country, community, in school? We believe they deserve to know that the state of North Carolina has failed to provide them with a sound basic education. And we would like to know, what is it that they would envision for themselves? What is it that they would like to achieve so that they can move themselves away from this narrative of failure? The final pedagogical stance is language matters. We must be mindful of how language spoken to and about our children is foundational to how we build healthy relationships with students. And so with this pedagogical stance, think about what kind of relationship you have with your students. All right, and be critical. I appreciate Dylan's framing of critical earlier. Think critically about those relationships. To what extent are we in a healthy relationship with our students? How can it be made stronger? We can ask questions through this pedagogical stance, like, how does our language place the burden of failure on students rather than the education system? How does our language create a deficit framing of students? And how does our language embrace the rich assets possessed by our students? And so if there's any comments from the gallery on language or examples of language that you would want to reflect on in this pedagogical stance. We find, in the program that I work with, we discuss language that misleads, language that uplifts, and language that affirms our students' lives. For example, think about this common discourse in our country around the achievement gap. Research shows that when racial groups stand on relatively equal footing, that achievement gap does not exist. Therefore, there is an opportunity gap that exists, or a curriculum gap that exists, a funding gap that exists. Some say a caring gap that exists. This opportunity gap language places a burden on the education system and on policymakers to meet the needs of students, whereas an achievement gap places the need on our students to pull themselves up by their bootstraps to try harder against the system that has process them out of schools routinely, failed to serve them, and in my state, has failed to meet their basic needs for an education. So shifting that language to place the burden away from him, from the, our students, can be important and meaningful. Second, how do we use this term urban in urban education? In my community, I noticed that some people would talk about the urban school on the east side of town, and it was clear when they talked about it, they were talking about a failing school and a violent community and all the things that kind of come as taboo with that term urban. However, the higher performing school, where our university professors Mason, their kids was also in that urban area, but we tend to talk about as international baccalaureate program. And I've never heard it referred to as an urban school. And so keep in mind, urban refers to population density. There are examples of success and failure in urban schools. So when we use or hear the word urban, are we talking about race? Are we using it as a proxy to say problematic things about our students and our community? Because if we are, those students in the community hear us and they get those messages. So can we shift that language? Finally, we believe, and I teach my students, that silence is a voice. It is most evident in the protest pictured on the screen before you of high school students in a silent protest indicating their belief that Black Lives Matter. Their silent protest has made people uncomfortable across this country. Equally, silence is a voice when those same high school students return to their schools and are met with silence from us. What message do they hear when they go out and take the bold stance to speak out for their community and return to their school and receive no educational guidance, no support, only silence toward this issue that is most pressing in our community? So can we interrogate and critique our own silence such that we may lift the silent voices of our students who are speaking to us loudly this summer? A few remarks as we wrap up. I think I do have a few minutes I'll have for questions as well. I believe, and my advice here is based on this remark from Brian Stevenson, and he suggests that we need to kind of get proximate to injustices, get close to it, and that's how we can create justice. And so I have three suggestions, I believe. The first one on building healthy relationships with our students, something we all want to do. So what can we do to promote that? I've talked about providing students with narratives that counter the deficit language and lift them up rather than kind of depress them with the language of achievement gap. It's also common in times such as these to hear diversity headlines. I hear things like, you know, this is the most diverse school in the district, or we're a majority minority campus. But what does that mean? What does that mean for the lived experiences of students in that school? What does that mean for you as a teacher in the curriculum that you teach? Someone once said to me about the school I've worked at, there are over 40 languages spoken at this school. And this pedagogical stances that I presented gave me the position to be able to say, well, you know, that's funny because I've only heard one language spoken at this school. What does it mean to be at a school where 40 languages are spoken and only one language is heard? What does that mean for the students who speak those 40 languages? So what this meant for me in my program is we invite those languages into the classroom. One way we did that is we were beginning our class with stretching routines, common for physical education. And someone would count to 10 or count to 20 or count to 30 as you do. And we said, we want this presentation to be in different languages. So we invite you to bring your language. And instead of counting for 30 seconds, you speak to us in your language for 30 seconds. And then we can have conversations about that language that build on that. You know, we learned so much from our students. We had ninth grade students who said, I had no idea that there were African countries that speak French. Others said, I had no idea that there were African countries that speak Arabic, right? So that's one way. What are the other ways that we can interrogate diversity headline to lift up our students and make sure they all matter and belong? In terms of getting local, data can be helpful. There may be several resources you can tap into. I found this source from ProPublica called Miseducation to be helpful. It has data from nearly every single school in the country. Very likely has data on race equity from the school every one of you teach at and the school district every one of you are employed by. So I would encourage you to go to this database and examine and consider what are the data that speak to my school, and is there racial inequity? And if so, how does that make you feel? And does your principal know about that? And what does your elected school board member know about that? What does your city council members think about that? Because to the extent that we have power in this democracy, it is at its peak at the local level. And so if we can begin to exercise it from where we're at in our schools, in our communities, we can build the momentum to affect things more broadly in our state and in our nation. And then finally, the notion of Black Lives Matter. I feel thankful for this movement that began in 2013, 2014, and has begun to mature to the point where its voices are heard today. I just read this summer the book by Fania Davis on race and restorative justice, and I appreciate this notion that the idea of Black Lives Matter and education as liberation has existed from the times of enslavement. And I think this offers us a pedagogical stance that we can move into school with. She noted that it was unlawful for enslaved Blacks to learn to read and write. When the slave master learned that his wife was teaching Frederick Douglass to read, he at once forbade it. But Douglass continued, and he became a leader of the anti-slavery and women's rights movement, later a best-selling author and a U.S. diplomat. And so that type of approach to education as liberation, as opposed to responding to Black Lives Matter with silence, is an example that can lift us up, as this quote of Frederick Douglass indicates. So thank you. I'll invite questions, maybe Jen or Sue, if you want to, you know, start that off or let me know how to field questions. I'm happy to discuss further.
Sure. Thank you so much, Michael, for that outstanding presentation. Was really fantastic. And because you were presenting, you probably didn't get a chance to look at, there were quite a few comments that actually came up in the chat box. I did notice early on a question that came up regarding the circle process. Somebody asked about how young or what kind of age would you begin with the circle process?
Yeah, so I've used it extensively with ninth grade. I've observed it used in elementary school. Let me take a step back to the question. There's no magic in the circle process. We did reading circles in my elementary school. There weren't restorative circles, but we were circled up. So there should be no age at which is prohibitive for you to use good pedagogy. But a part of that question may be, how can we get at some of these issues of harm in a circle process? I think it works quite well in secondary education. In elementary school, to the extent that I'm aware, teachers have used this well to build relationships among students in proactive ways, to help them learn about each other, to bring evidence of different cultures into circles more than they have the reactive way, the kind of solving a major dispute type of way. But there are some resources I'd be happy to share with folks if you're in a primary school setting to dig into that a little deeper. I haven't myself done it beyond secondary.
Michael, there's a follow-up to this from in the chat. And it says, can you give an example of a restorative circle? How many kids, one question, mediation?
Yeah, so the program I run, we have 25 students typically, and we have 90 minutes in physical education class. That's twice a week on Tuesday and Thursday. And so all students participate. So that could be 25 to 30, depending on how many student volunteers I may have with me. And I mentioned there's like the levels of questions. So often we start the semester off with just super easy get to know you questions. But later on, we ask students to identify, let me back up. They come to understand how we define harm. So we talk to them about structural issues in the community. And then we have conversations about what types of harm communities are experiencing. Now, one way that's been useful for me to calibrate that is to ask students to ask the question. So once they get experience with restorative practices, they can bring their question with some framework to us. What I've found is a lot of the athletes will ask questions that get at structural issues, like why does our rival high school have better facilities than we do? Why do they have better equipment than we do? And so they frame that question in a way that's accessible for ninth graders, but yet still attaches to these critical areas that I'm thinking about.
We have a couple more minutes if anybody wants to pose a question, either unmute yourself and ask, or if you want to put it in the chat box.
Michael, I have a question for you. So the great work that you're doing in the physical education program at the school that you're at, how is that supported or not supported with the school culture?
It's in direct conflict with the school culture. It's the most, we're there because it's the most punitive school in the district. So you saw those high suspension numbers, they produce the most suspensions. It's a big challenge for us, but we've been doing it for 3 years now. And we've started to see some, openness to the ideas. And so our larger goal is to get to a place where we can change the school culture. I realized going into this school that I just don't have the power to do that without some sustained engagement. And that means showing up, you know, twice a week for 3 years to run this program. But that has gotten me into a position where I can have conversations with the school leadership and also the school district leadership around these policies. It can be difficult to navigate because we're talking about issues of race equity and African-American suspension. You know, we're talking about a school that was founded as a Black high school. And so the race issues are complex. There are, you know, white principals suspending Black students at extraordinary rates, and there are Black principals suspending Black students at extraordinary rates. And I always struggle. So you always get the question, you know, what if a student comes to school and does something really bad? Well, you have to punish them, right? And so we always move to those practice areas before we start with the paradigm areas, right? As I was saying earlier. And so it's a part of this is trying to be in that space and figure out how we can get in those paradigm shifting conversations and reduce the extent to which we have access to exclusionary tools, because it seems like as long as we have exclusionary tools at the ready, then we're gonna use them. Then they're gonna be employed going forward. So, you know, that's been my experience. I'll also say that this is not always where I have been in terms of pedagogical stances. I mean, I've been trying to learn more and be in this space since 2016, since I moved to Greensboro. And I just say that because if someone feels like, gosh, I'm behind or, I feel bad I haven't been thinking about this. You know, I think I was late to the party too, but sometimes I have a book beside me I'm looking over at, and it's called Start Where You Are, But Don't Stay There. And so when you begin to kind of see that things aren't the way they should be, just start with where you're at, and you all have amazing skills and assets to build on. So build on that to try to kind of move toward a more just approach.
So we have a question. Do you involve family in any of these practices at the school that you're at?
I have not been able to. So we would like to. You know, I'm just not in a position to as an outsider at this point. I will say when we went to this school, we wanted to do an after-school program because that's where the Hellison TPSR model has been mostly that. And we wanted to, you know, get kids who have been in trouble, been suspended from school, give them an after school program. What we realized is that you can't get at structural change that way, because if it was wildly successful, we would enroll, what, 50 students maybe in a school that has 1,500. But physical education in North Carolina and in most other states, ninth grade physical education has conflict resolution written into these standards, into the state standards. And so what we have been able to say is this is the content of physical education. This isn't some, you know, side project that we decided, hey, let's integrate it here and there, that this is the main core content that we should be teaching. And I argue that if we're in a school that is suspending students at the rates that I just, that the data shows, then it should be, because physical education is the only place in high schools that has a conflict resolution standard, physical education and health. So it's the only place that we can give students this. So that might be another tool that you can latch onto, depending on what your Ohio state standards might suggest.
Well, fortunately, unfortunately, our time is up. It is 11 o'clock. And once again, I just want to thank Michael and our previous presenters of Dylan and Sarah, who provided very thought-provoking discourse today to get us thinking about our own social identities, our pedagogical practices, our curriculum and instruction that we provide and offer to our students, whether in higher education or P-12. We know that ultimately this conversation is just a start. We need to continue having further conversations, engaging in more discourse and more professional development, and that we need to ultimately take action. And that's the whole part of this, is that this is a continuum. And so when Michael says that I started this in 2016 and I'm not in the same place, I can certainly say the same thing for myself. And the more that I think that I know, the more that I realize that I don't know, or the more that I question myself and what I'm able to embark when it comes to my scholarship and also my teaching practices. And so we hope that you will continue to stay on board for focusing on social justice and health education, which will be right after this break, beginning at 11:15. Sue, do you want to say anything more before we sign off?
Just know that, again, just to echo Jen, thank you to Michael, Dylan, Sarah for wonderful presentations this morning. It's so great that we could bring you to Ohio and for our folks to hear from you. And just know that Jen and I are in state. We're here to support you in whatever way we can to all OFED members. So thank you, everyone.
Thanks.
Thanks for having us.
Welcome back, everybody. Can you hear me? Thanks, buddy. All right, we're gonna get started with our afternoon session with Scott Todnum. Did I say it right?
Yes, you did.
Awesome, I'm trying to practice. I'm gonna give you a little bit of background. We're excited to have him. He is from Naperville, or he taught in Naperville, Illinois. He was the 2019 Health Teacher of the Year. He is the author of two puberty books for young people, Growing Up Great and Starting Off Smart. I think I need both of those, even though I am not a young person anymore. He also has worked on social diversity and multicultural teams. So we are super excited to have you with us here today, Scott. So I am not going to take up any more of your time. So I'm going to hand it over to you.
Great. Thank you. Hello, everyone. Thanks for having me. I'm so excited to be a part of this. I've been tuning in all morning, and there are some outstanding ideas going on. I'm just so fortunate to be a part of this, the Ohio group, but also the nationwide and worldwide group as well. Is my audio okay? Good. I am going to share my screen. I hope that I can do that. And we'll kind of go from there. I'm going to also give you the link to join or to view anything that you want afterwards. Everything that I do is generally public. And if everything works well, we'll try and view a YouTube video that I do. Screen, I'm hoping. Yes, there we go. And I'm going to go to present mode so that we can enlarge that. Just let me know if that's not working, but I think it is. I'm hoping it is. Okay. All right. So everything that I have, like I said, is public. So this includes everything on these slides. And this is a little bit more difficult to do than talking in person, isn't it? We've all kind of figured that out. But we're gonna make the most of it. So the Google Slides here is a tiny URL for this is tinyurl.com. And then I made it social/social health topics. And I don't think that the case matters. I think that it can be lowercase or uppercase. Okay. You can also connect on media. I know that there's a huge, great online. Learning community on Twitter podcast. So there's all these different connections that are out there. If you're on there, I am as well. And then even this picture that I need to update since growing my quarantine beard, this will get you to my email. This is a link to my email. Okay. All right. So let's dive in. Here's our big picture concept for today. Social health development. We're looking to connect our health skill standards, our national standards, SEL competencies, teaching tolerance standards, as well as social health content. Today specifically, let's examine one specific lesson that I've had a little bit of success with to help students comprehend some of these social health concepts. I'm at the middle school level. This will be year 20 for me. And my ultimate goal at the middle school level at 6th, 7th, and 8th grade is always health literacy. And health literacy, as a definition from Shape America, is of course the ability to access, understand, appraise, apply, and advocate for health information. Now, I'm not necessarily using the terms appraise, something like that, with like a 6th grader. But this is in the back of my mind at all times as my ultimate course goal. I have students for 9 weeks at the 6th, 7th, and 8th grade level. I'm very fortunate to see them each year. And that's a great thing to connect from year to year. I know not all districts, not all states have that ability. I do in the suburbs of Chicago here. And again, I take that and I know the fortune of seeing students each and every year to work on health literacy before moving on to the high school level. Even though I teach at the middle school level, I think there are some things today that are usable at the elementary school level as well as the high school level. Our skills from standards 2 through 8 include some kind of short terms that help us easily identify without saying the entire sentence, of course. So besides the core concepts of standard 1 for our national standards, the rest of these are all skills-based. And I took these images from RMC Health. We're gonna focus on potentially one of these skills. Although there's not really a wrong way to approach this, I think there's just definitely a right way, depending on your school and community, on how to set up your units, where to weave your content in. I'm taking the first one listed, which is standard 2, analyzing influences, but I think there's a great place for social health concepts in many of these skill standards, like communication, advocacy for sure. All right. So we're going to see this again show up. I'm sure that a lot of people are familiar with the CASEL SEL wheel. We have 2 social emotional learning competencies that deal with the self. We have 2 in green that deal with social health, and then 1 with decision making there in yellow. I'm just going to highlight a few of these that you can see. I'm just directly taking this from the collaborative for social emotional learning, CASEL. One of those is social awareness. So look at these terms and look at some of the verbiage that is on their website. You can see empathy is big in here. We can see diverse backgrounds and cultures being listed in there. So outstanding wording. We don't need to fight SEL. We need to weave it in and enjoy the fact that we're all working towards SEL in different content areas. In health education in particular, we've been doing this for years and decades. So this is an exciting way to include this in our skill standards, as well as include the entire school, the entire community in these SEL competencies. Relationship skills. You know, these are the things that some of us are losing, and maybe not losing, we're definitely lacking with our online learning that's happening from COVID and the COVID pandemic and quarantine time. So how do we do this through a screen, or are we going to be on a blended or hybrid model next fall? How do you end up doing this when seeing students only, you know, potentially a few times a week, if that? And there's ways to do this, but I don't have all the answers. I just believe that there are ways to continue to develop relationship skills even through the screen. And then finally, one highlight for us today will be decision making, and that's going to come through in the specific lesson that I try and highlight. Okay, I've got, I'm sorry if I have some clicking in the background. My own kids are playing with toys in the background. So hopefully everything is okay with the audio and visual so far. I'm going to go to teaching tolerance for my social justice framework. This is it's tolerance.org, and this is an organization that provides standards a lot like Castlewell for SEL, specifically towards social diversity, tolerance, and justice. And they break down their anti-bias education into four main, what they call anchors and anchor standards. And those are specifically identity, diversity, justice, and action, with the ultimate goal of getting to action and not just, you know, reading materials, but acting on some of these things. What can I do? What can we do as educators to include all of our students, no matter what their background, no matter what the community, to realizing that social justice is something that we believe in, first off, and that we are actively working towards in education. Try and break down some of the systemic issues that have occurred, that have perpetuated in education, and oftentimes white educators will worry that they are doing the wrong thing. But we had just seen an outstanding couple of presentations about not staying silent. Michael Hemphill had a great point, is that if students come in and teachers or other students are silent on issues like Black Lives Matter, then that speaks volumes as well. So instead of worrying so much about saying or teaching the wrong thing, we should be worried a little bit more about not doing anything at all. Teaching tolerance has a great framework for educators to begin and start that. They also have outstanding framework for people that have begun into that process and are looking for just a little bit more. So let me highlight a couple more things as we get into the background on some of the issues discussed here on from Ohio, AFERD, including social justice, like identity for students. They have anchor standards that they call. We also have specific towards grade level, just like our national standards will have performance indicators. Teaching tolerance has some of those specifics too. So you can see this identity for students. We can see the other term that just came up, diversity, what that means to building respect, empathy, connection. We have a justice standard, anchor standard here about some of the biases and injustice around the world, not just today, but also historically. And then finally, our action standard we're going to come to in just a little bit. So let's get into an example skill. Let's take National Health Education Standard number 2, analyzing influences. For my particular grade level of 6th, 7th, or 8th grade, I've got specifics that get me into describing the influence of culture, explaining how our norms affect our behaviors, and also what peers can do to influence positively or negatively. So let's take this example skill of analyzing influences. Let's put this with example content from my specific district about healthy and unhealthy relationships. Maybe a better term would be risk behavior versus preventative behavior. Maybe that's better terms. and our essential questions around social health and intolerance. What is prejudice, first of all? What is privilege? Is there a difference between equality and equity? And then our strategies of explaining intolerance and identifying some of these factors towards action, like empathy and inclusion. So that's a lot to take on, especially at a younger age level, but we are up to the task. We can do that. It just needs to be age appropriate with terminology. At the eighth grade level, my students can understand the terms stereotype, prejudice, and discrimination. So with specific definitions of intolerance, as well as specific definitions of privilege, empathy versus sympathy, equality and equity, and then inclusion. These are some example terms that I'm going to use in the eighth grade health classroom. An example unit for me would be built on that national standard while weaving in social emotional learning and while also then finding the right spot for content. Now, again, it doesn't mean that this is the only way to do things for a social health unit. I've just found some success at the eighth grade level to use analyzing influences. And so I wanted to get into some group activities because it's social health after all. When actually in person, develop relationship skills. If it's through the screen, still find a way to develop those relationship skills, interpersonal communication, and decision-making as previous skill units that we're basing the next step on. So let's pretend that in sixth grade, I focused on one of my units, a skill unit of communication. Later in the year, and then maybe in seventh grade, I used decision-making as a skill unit. And again, I'm weaving content in and out of there for health class. I'm going to build on those skills. And then by the start of eighth grade, I find that analyzing influences is an outstanding starting point. My group reflections that will take place, you know, Q&A in the classroom, conversations, small group, large group activities, that's going to develop some social awareness. So that's what I'm trying to do all at the same time. And we're up to the task, just a matter of how to do that. So let's get into an example lesson. I have taken an old stress activity that I found from maybe Tom Jackson or somewhere like that from decades ago that has basically been a stress and distress versus eustress activity with shoelaces. And I like to offer one shoelace per student in the health classroom, again, when we're in person, and then put a timer on the front board and ask the students to take their shoelace and look at all of the knots previously tied in there and then untie as many knots in that shoelace as possible. Now, I need to be very cognizant of the group that I have in the classroom. For instance, if I have a student that is not able to, does not have the manipulative skills to untie knots, I want to know that ahead of time. It's very usable in this lesson if there are students that aren't able to actually untie laces. I just want to make sure that I'm not causing frustration unnecessarily. So there's some background that needs to take place in knowing your students and knowing what plans are in place with IEPs or 504s with manipulative skills before starting this lesson. But otherwise, any frustration is totally usable. It's kind of the purposeful part of this. Untie as many knots as possible. Now, some of the shoelaces have a bunch of knots. Some have zero or one. Some are tighter than others. So this is all usable in the lesson. We then sometimes will ask students to tie as many knots in the shoelace as possible in 30 seconds. And again, some students are able to do that a little bit better than others, but the concept is just to get them moving. So I want them to be a little active, not just in their own learning mentally, but physically, just a little bit of activity. I might even stop at the untie point. And that's the part where we're gonna jump in on a lesson and video lesson where you're gonna see me talk to students after untying the knots. Some of the background here would be some discussion points that we're skipping through is which part was easier to lose yourself in, tying or untying? Or in this particular lesson, I jump right into how the shoelaces connect to real people. How does the stress involved connect to a real person's stress? And then I want to jump in and toe concepts of diversity and privilege that have already been previously discussed, stereotype, prejudice, discrimination. I want to talk about kind of all of this and dip my toe into some of those concepts. So I'm going to take you in. We're going to go into this specific lesson, which I happen to just call shoelace jump rope by the end of it. We're going to go into our health classroom from last year. And we're going to pick up at a point where we're reflecting right after the untying part of the lesson. So I'm going to see if this is working. Please jump in and tell me if I'm not, if this doesn't play correctly, if the audio doesn't go through. But what's happening here is we have just untied all the knots, and I'm going to ask students, let me put the volume up just a little bit, to process just a little on what the knots mean and what the shoelaces mean. So let's see, assuming this is okay, let's jump in.
So let's relate this to people and a lifeline and a person's livelihood. Are there people born with more knots than others? And what do I mean by that? Turn and talk. What could cause a person to have more knots from birth? What influences in their life impact the fact that they have more knots to untie just from birth? Ready, go. Turn and talk. What influences on life could cause a person to have more knots just from birth? What do I mean by that?
I'm going to pause it. Is everything okay with audio? Can somebody help me out, Lisa? Or?
Scott, you're fine. The audio is working great.
Thank you very much.
Let's personify the shoelace. What impacts a person to have more, quote unquote, knots? Help us out. Say again. Like what health issues? Okay, so some type of physical issues? Physical health issues, maybe a physical disability potentially? Or maybe we think less about disabilities, maybe challenges. What should we add to that? Physical health issues from birth. What else could we add that impacts a person to have more knots in their strength? All right, so poverty maybe. What if we flip off that? So just not poverty, not just poverty, but maybe born into some wealth. Being rich versus being poor, okay? What else is out there? Physical limitations, money, and? Yeah, absolutely. Some type of mental disabilities or mental illness. Or again, maybe it's more like learning challenges or mental challenges. Do you consider these knots a problem?
No.
Yes.
Depends on the person. Some people are like, yes, this was really irritating. I couldn't get the knot out. I thought it was a problem. Maybe people are going through life as if we're going and bouncing from problem to problem, trying to solve problems in life. But maybe life isn't always just a problem to be solved. Can we function and live with knots in our life? Let's say we're born with some type of mental limitation, physical limitation. What if we bring up gender? Could there be more knots to untie just based on gender? Should we dare bring up race? What color are the strings that I gave you? Black and?
White.
White and?
Brown.
In the past, some people are like, but I'm not black, white, or brown. I'm more kind of orange tint. I'm a little bit more pink. Yeah, we could have all different types of shoelaces up there. We should have a bunch of different colors. But dare we bring up race when talking about challenges in life? And what if we're dealt these knots? Well, okay. Somebody has just a string that has no knots in it, and the challenge is untie as many as you can in 30 seconds, and they're just sitting there with nothing to do. Maybe that's the concept of privilege. Maybe you've heard that term before. Privilege. Just being fortunate enough to be born with less problems as some people view them. But even if we have knots, you have worth. You still can function. Just because we have knots. Maybe some are easy untied, maybe some we just leave in there and we just live. Plus, if you untie them, anybody have such a tight knot that they untied it but you can still see where it is?
Yeah.
There's an indention there? No, it's had a mark on the string. It's left a mark. Again, it's not necessarily a mark of shame. It's not something that causes us not to be able to function. We can still use the shoelace. But maybe that's a concept of privilege. Okay, so let's take a volunteer. Who's going to help me out? Who's brave enough to come up in front of everybody for my next challenge? Mark, that's you? Yeah. Okay, bring your shoelace. Stand right there, face me. Right in the middle. Yep, back up a little bit. You're going to need a little bit of space. Okay. Mark versus Mr. Totten. It's a jump rope challenge. How many jumps can you make? No, let's change it. Let's go for speed. No longer 30 seconds on the board. First to 10. First to 10. Here's the rules. You have to hold on to each side of the string. And you're going to jump. Just like a regular jump rope. First to 10. You first. Okay. No, wait. Let me set up better than that. Who's counting for Mark? Good. Okay. Who's counting for me? All right, I got 10. He already started. Somebody say 3, 2, 1, go.
3, 2, 1, go.
First to 10.
You can do it, Mark.
Wait, where's my applause? And clap for that. Was that fair?
No.
But I have a knot.
But I have like 4 knots.
Did that stop you? Did the more number of the higher number of knots in his string or his rope, did that cause him to be slower? No. What's the issue? Yeah, of course. It's the fact that I have a jump rope and he doesn't. What would be fair?
Both have.
So the concept of equality would be we both have jump ropes. Or we both have, where's my string? Fall on the ground. Or we both have a string. But yet, are we going to jump rope very well with this? No. So instead of this short string, to eliminate that, but equality is a little different than equity. Equality is we're having the same thing offered to us, no matter where we started. I gave you the same string, but there you go. It's still different with the number of knots in there. The same length, that's equality, but yet we're starting at different points. The concept of equity would be, what does Mark need? What does Mr. Todden need? What do I need? That's the concept of equity. But even past that, we've seen a lot of those images and maybe some of the metaphors with equality versus equity. What if we scrap that concept even and we just go for inclusion, including people? So let's include other people. All right, here's the next challenge. How many people can we get to jump rope at once? One jump at the same time, simultaneous jump. How many people can we get to jump once? You want the jump rope?
Well, we can just tie all the races together.
Mm-hmm. Go ahead. Who's starting it? Mark's starting. Who else is starting theirs together?
I have 10 knots.
Okay, go. Josh, you're going to tie together? Knots. Mark says tie together.
Okay, we're going to pause there. At this point, you can hear, hopefully you could hear, I'm guiding students to eventually make the decision on their own to tie the laces together, okay? And I put out the challenge to get active. We're up and moving. We're not reflecting on anything yet besides the initial challenges of untying knots, of jumping rope versus me, Mr. Todnum. And now how can we get a bunch of people under one rope at the same time? You heard the student come up with the idea, and I'm kind of gently pushing them there, come up with the idea, let's tie the shoelaces together. And so from here, I'm going to show you just one last 1 minute clip. They start to tie together. They start to get people involved in a gigantic jump rope activity, essentially, right here in the classroom. Let me go to the right spot. And they get 3 students, 5 students to jump, 7 students. At this point, they have 15 students ready to jump at the same time. So we're going to jump in for one last 30 second to a minute clip, and then we'll wrap things up.
Okay, Mark, let's push that. Get it.
Even as an observer. Yeah.
Okay, so the excitement builds from there. If you're interested, it's on YouTube. They had viewed initially the ropes and the knots as a problem. And towards the end, they are not viewing the knots as problems anymore. They are viewing them as the solution. So uniting together to get everybody included and involved was that simple active moment where then afterwards I can ask for some reflection. So the social health activity there is uniting, is combining national health standards, SEL, teaching tolerance standards, as well as social health content. Here's again what I was trying to get to, a group activity with relationship skills, communication, decision-making, also some social awareness and analyzing the influences on us, including peers. At one point in the activity, there's positive peer pressure to become involved, and the excitement just builds the entire time. Now, this isn't going to be done in just one lesson. So this could be early on, this could be middle of the unit. It's not the only lesson happening, nor should it ever be. The anchor standard for action is where maybe I want to go afterwards, as students start to recognize where they are involved, where they can be involved in inclusion versus exclusion, in justice instead of justice. And that's so simple is so simple to get them off of the focus of people first, to then bring the focus back to people in the end. So our learning outcomes here as we wrap up that I've had some success with, that you're welcome to toy around with and build to become a better unit, a better lesson, could be the assessment piece afterwards. What project do I want to get into, an advocacy project after that? Is it simply journaling? Is it talking through scenarios, Q&A essay? But that's where I would go eventually, using this active moment in class as a unifying point. And we know that the brain, just like the body, is a sponge after activity. So the brain for an adolescent is looking for the reason. The abstract activity was a jump rope or a shoelace, untying some knots in a shoelace. How do you bridge the gap between that abstract notion and the real part of growing up, of learning what social justice is, et cetera, et cetera? Okay. I know that there are going to be questions about how do you do this remotely? Is there a possibility of doing that in a setting that's safe? Could we get students their own shoelace at home? That's where I'm stumped as well. Maybe it's getting shoelaces for the students to have, and if there's a point where instead of tying the knot, you end the activity there. I think there are ways to do this in a hybrid or remote learning setting. I would just implore you to try and think about how that could be done, as I'm doing the same for next school year. So I'm happy to brainstorm on some of that. How do we do that? But I wanted to make sure that I gave you some resources. So in here, the social justice link, this is tolerance.org. That gives you all of the necessary standards from teaching tolerance. I'm giving some Black Lives Matter resources here, as well as an outstanding list of resources, books, reading material for our LGBTQ community. And just a few about special needs. I might update this as we continue into next school year so I can get more resources involved for any educators out there. Okay, so I know I'm kind of pressing for time. I don't know if there's some questions out there. I hope that everything came through on audio and the visual. The full lesson is there on YouTube. Again, it's not the end all be all, but it's just something I found some success with. In teaching, or at least starting to teach, age-appropriate social justice concepts at the middle school level. I'm going to stop my share.
Maria, do you want to monitor questions for Scott?
I'd be happy to. Do you want to
All right, looks like Maria is having some audio difficulties. So If you have any questions for Scott, you can either raise your hand or put it in the chat box. Lots of positive comments. Scott, I don't know if you're monitoring the chat, but people saying they would have loved to have been a student in your health class, as would I have. Thank you for sharing today. Anybody questions?
I think my major question is how can I do something similar from a remote? I'm working on that now. How do I do this through the screen? You know, am I trying to get every student a shoelace? I'm not quite sure. I'm going to be in a hybrid setting, meaning I'll see students a couple days a week this fall. So this would be something that I potentially could do without being too close to each other. I have to figure that stuff out. So I know that would be some of the biggest questions. What's my idea on how do I do this in like the pandemic world? I wish I had all the answers. You know, I'll have to brainstorm more. I think there is a way to do it. Even if it's viewing the video for reflection from a remote setting, I have the ability for the students to view, you know, it's right there on YouTube. So it's not the same. You know, if I presented in person, I generally have even adults involved in the, you know, the knots. It's a little bit easier to comprehend when you've been involved yourself. So I know that's one question that for sure would come up. Can I do this in the pandemic world? I'm sure I may have missed some other details in there, but. Oh, I thought there would be more questions. That's why I tried to give some time. Could we ask next year's or last year's previous students for suggestions on how to distance? Yeah, potentially. I could also have gloves for anybody that's going to tie the knots together. Maybe instead of the entire group, it's, you know, just a couple of students distanced, you know, 6 feet apart. It's a long string tied together, but there is quite a bit of setup involved. There's some thinking ahead of time. I know we're kind of looking, some of us, for quick filler activities. I don't think this is one of those you can just jump right into tomorrow. I think you need to think through what you have for space, what you need for distancing. Any other insights on SEL? Is that the question, Maria?
You're hidden plain sight. Like you have them in your room, like for way kids to talk about their emotions.
I think it was ways to talk about emotions, maybe. I'm so sorry, you're lagging quite a bit. Yeah, ways to talk about the SEL competencies, they don't stop at one lesson or one unit. So I find that incorporating those into mental health lessons is a particularly great spot, specifically with mindfulness activities. Yeah, so, you know, to talk about, I like, for instance, this lesson took the focus off of the students. We didn't just jump into this lesson on social justice and say, hi, all my students of color. Can you talk to us about your experience being a Black person in America? No way. You know, my Asian American, my Indian American students, can you talk about what it means to be, you know, or female or non-binary gender identifying students? Can you talk, notice the focus isn't right on that. There's no reason to do that with emotions either. For young people to take the focus off of themselves for a while and then make that abstract metaphor, that analogy, can be done with emotions. We don't want to just ask a middle school or high school student or elementary school student, for instance, anybody, even adult, how are you feeling today? Because you know what the answer is going to be. How are you today? Well, the answer is going to be, I'm fine. What does fine mean? You know, so to get students to be able to label their emotions is tricky. But by taking the focus off of them, putting it on either a quick video clip or even a prop, a manipulative prop, Maria, you're kind of lending me towards an activity that I enjoy using toys in the classroom, specifically animals, movie characters. Which one best describes your mood at the moment? There's an excellent book out by Mark Brackett called Permission to Feel. So if you're looking to have students identify where they are feeling on a almost like a humongous chart with vocabulary words, instead of just fine, I'm feeling fine, we're expanding their ability to, first of all, identify an emotion, a feeling, and then also what their response might be to that feeling. That's my go-to would be Mark Brackett's Permission to Feel. But in the actual health classroom, any way that you can get the students to think outside the box, to think abstractly for a while, and then bring it back around to reflection about themselves, I adore. I love that. I love the props and the metaphors and analogies. So I would absolutely encourage any educator to check that out. I have a few ideas on a blog post on mindfulness that kind of describe what Maria is hinting towards. So that's what, you know, I'm just rambling, but that's, you know, something that I think of with SEL is not just directly questioning, but bringing it back around to the direct question you wanted to get to in the first place. Role modeling is okay without sharing too much as the actual teacher. You know, there's no reason for a teacher to disclose everything to their students, but they need some role modeling on how to express themselves, no matter what, SEL, goal setting, self-management, social justice, to also just talk about it, you know, to not be afraid of speaking about emotions, about social intolerance, about sexual wellness. So now I'm on to bigger picture items, but to take all of that stuff on. To see a white educator, and students don't know I have necessarily a small Native American background in me, but outwardly I'm very much a white educator. To be an ally to speaking of Black Lives Matter, again, worry less about saying the wrong thing and more about just saying nothing, you know, opening up the dialogue for students. So that doesn't really answer everything, but I'm just kind of talking to the screen. So thanks for the opportunity to do this, Lisa and Maria and everybody in Ohio. I'm looking, trying to check out some of the other questions in the chat. Some people are kind of talking about using other ways, like Mary talks about duct tape potentially. So I love it. I would just ask you to take that and run with it. That's all I do. I steal ideas all the time. And then just build on them, you know, so it isn't my thing, please embellish, keep it going. It's just one lesson, you know. Yeah, draw feelings, that's pretty neat.
All right, Scott, it has been awesome. We so appreciate your time.
Thank you, Tracy.
You're welcome. Our next session is at 12:30. It'll be our last session. It's pre-recorded. And then Kevin and I will be live to answer any questions that you have about advocacy. So everybody feel free to take a break. If you have further questions for Scott, he had his email and his Facebook and his Twitter up. So feel free to contact him that way, or you can reach out to us and we can put you in touch with him. So we will see everybody at 12:15. 12:30, sorry, I'm getting the official time. If you are need a PD certificate, it will be emailed to the email that you registered with. So I didn't put that in the chat room. I'm just gonna let you know that. All right, see everybody at 12:30. Thank you again, Scott. Bye, everybody.
Thank you so much. Thanks, Tracy. Thanks, everybody.
You're welcome. Thank you. Great. And... Hello. Welcome back, everybody. Hope you had a nice, delicious lunch. Hope you have a chance to sit down and digest that lunch now. Kevin, did you get yours eaten or are you still eating?
It's inhaled and ready to go.
All right, so now you get to be entertained by Kevin and I. So if you don't know who I am, I'm the Overd president. And Kevin, I'll let you introduce yourself because you do such a fabulous job.
Kevin Larson, full-time job is at Wright State University for Health and Physical Education. My other full-time job is Overd Advocacy Chair. And so I'm happy to be here today to talk advocacy.
All right, go for it.
So today's presentation is a little bit different. I think we've recorded a webinar a couple of weeks ago, I think it was in June, actually, probably more than a couple of weeks. We recorded an advocacy webinar, so we're going to kind of do this in a flip format. We're assuming that you'll either go back and watch that video at a later time, or you've already watched it and you're here to ask some questions and to get some additional information from Tracy and I as we share a little bit more. Just to kick things off, so we would appreciate you diving in with questions into the chat box. Tracy's going to help organize those and ask me questions a bit while I fumble around with technology and show you a couple of things that are up there and up and available for you to use on the Overd website. So Lisa and Tracy, if you can help monitor for me and then just chime in with questions when we start to get them in. Folks who are watching, please share your questions and we'll do our best to answer them. So first thing to share is that we have our advocacy page is now updated. And so within that advocacy page, we've reshaped it just a little bit to focus on not just advocating for health education standards, but advocating for both quality health education and physical education. So you'll see initially there is some work about why it is important for health education and physical education and how it fits within a wider WISC approach, and it's very similar to the presentation, again, that you can view online. Also within this page, you get down into some of our priorities and initiatives. You'll get additional information about both of the health education standards bills and also how to develop a health education curriculum in your district. So feel free to click on any of those links and you'll get to our health education model curriculum, and you'll also get some more information about the bills that are out there. And I'm sure we'll get a chance to talk about those in just a little bit. And down below that, again, additional information to support the legislation that we have right now, 121 and 165, the push to get Ohio to be the 50th state with health education standards. And there are a variety of handouts there. Those handouts could be beneficial to not only advocate for the bills, but also it might be helpful for you to advocate to redevelop or redesign your local curriculum. So we find all of those handouts to be useful along the way. We're hopefully going to add a few more things. I need to do a little bit of advocacy work to help you identify who your local representatives are so that when we have some campaigns to reach out or to do some speak out events virtually, we'll have those up there. But make sure you use your advocacy page for all your updates and resources. So I'll pause there for a second to see if we have any questions or anybody wants to direct the conversation another direction.
No questions in the chat box.
No questions yet. All right, the second piece that we would like you to access, and this is going to be next Monday's presentation when we discuss the pandemic and the return to school activities. We have published guidance to help you, and we do feel that advocacy is not just advocating for legislation at the state or federal level. Advocacy is really a grassroots effort. And so in that grassroots efforts, we convene the task force. And then through that task force, we have generated some of these return to school resources. One comment or overview of these resources, they're not meant to answer every question that you have. They probably generate more questions than answers. I think many folks who have engaged in the tools have said, I've answered a lot of questions, but I have a few more. And so that's where we think that the resources have been helpful. They'll answer questions for you, but also at the same time, you'll still have additional questions that you could ask locally or to your colleagues also to help. But our response obviously is going to be local. Each school and each district are going to be making their choices, but we did provide on this page additional guidance. We think the Shape America document was excellent to get us started for considerations for physical education, health education, and physical activity. And with that, we also provided additional quality health education and physical education guidance. And again, that's really just our advocacy document that I'll walk through here in just a minute, because that should help us generate some questions about advocacy moving forward. You'll also get some planning materials that you can start to access, whether that's linking the physical education evaluation to what you might be planning to do next year in whatever instructional format, if that's online, face-to-face, or some sort of hybrid model. We think these planning tools can be helpful. And then the same resources are available for health education also. So those are some of the pieces that we have. And then obviously we link back out to CDC Ohio and also some other resources that might be helpful planning as you go back to school. But again, the main focus of today was advocacy, and it's tough to draw the line between planning to go back to school and advocacy, but we'll spend more time with this next week, so.
Okay, Kevin, question, is there a health certification required to teach physical education to teach health?
Sorry, question again.
Is there a health certification required for physical education? And then underneath it says to teach health.
So let me help with this real quick. So there is a requirement for all newly hired physical educators throughout the state to have a teaching license. So that is on the books, that any newly hired person in the position of physical education, it's a requirement that you have a license. Trying to decipher the question, health education licensure is not required within Ohio Revised Code. So it's not required by law like it is in physical education. It's highly recommended, and we typically haven't heard a lot of stories about the challenges associated with that. So health education is not required, but highly, highly recommended.
Lisa's answering the next question. What is the name of the pre-recorded video? We're gonna put up the link. I just lost the chat room. Hang on. Sorry. That's it. Oh, can current PE teachers get grandfathered?
Yes, because the law was any newly hired physical education teacher. So if you were previously hired, even within the district, so let's say I was a math teacher for 20 years. Technically, I'm not a new hire, and so I would be grandfathered in to be able to teach it. So, and there are other mechanisms in place. If a district needs flexibility, you know, there is the pursuit. If you're pursuing a licensure at the time, you're still able to teach also. So there's some ways around it. It's not necessarily a hard and fast rule all the time, per se. So districts do have some flexibility.
Allison, I'm not sure if you're asking a question or just making a statement. So if you're asking a question, can you add to it in the chat box, please? Okay, Kevin, you can keep going.
I pulled up the presentation that is online in case we have questions or concerns about anything that might have been in the presentation or anything that pops up along the way. So I just pulled that up, but I'm happy to keep working through this. I guess to start, while we wait for a few more questions, or if folks want to target just a little bit, and this piggybacks on the idea of what is advocacy and differentiating between advocacy and the work that we do, there really isn't a difference. All of you are advocates basically all the time. And so as we move forward in the work that we do, one of the main reasons why we've updated and provided resources for you is that make sure that you're informed. And it's difficult to know the requirements, the recommendations, and best practices. So we're trying our best to make sure that you're updated with that. And that's the quality health education and physical education document, is to let you know of all the requirements and recommendations. Kind of a one-stop shop for you to do that. I think the other piece is to make sure that you know your outcomes and why it's important to have health education and physical education. Both of those pieces are going to be really important moving forward. And then also making sure that you communicate and relate. As we move forward, there are going to be different folks that are motivated by different reasons. Some people are motivated by data and maybe brain science research. Other people are motivated by the obesity epidemic. Other people are motivated by healthy students and a whole child approach. And others that have had, you know, it's become more and more popular to have an SEL focused. Make sure that you know your audience and what they might be motivated by, and then that helps you build the case and build a connection to them. And sometimes your why isn't always their why. And so some of the resources that we provide to you is a way to get you to think about different whys that might be out there and ways that you can connect to people to encourage them to support what it is that you want to accomplish or the issue that you're advocating for. And again, as we move back, just to take a step back in terms of what we're advocating for, I think moving forward, our opportunities for health education, physical education, is really enhanced by the by current events. Whether you're looking at what's up here now is the ODE strategic plan moving forward from 2019 to 2024, which focuses on the whole child, and you can see us present in well-rounded content. You can also, the messages have been sent loud and clear that kids need to be back to school because kids need school to be healthy. And so we play a key role in that. Whether it is our given content areas, health education, physical education, a key component, but also all the work that we do in our schools collectively, whether it's our work with school nurses, school counselors, whether it's with classroom teachers through social emotional learning, all those pieces lead to supporting the whole child. And again, knowing that we're creating kids that are healthy, safe, engaged, supported, and challenged is going to be a key piece to sustaining the work that we do, but also building that to make sure kids can achieve the success and their fullest potential.
Kevin, lots of questions.
Okay, sorry. Go ahead.
Lots of questions from PE teachers asking if they should add health certification, because when they've either tried to get jobs, they are looking for somebody who's dual certified. Okay, hang on. And then somebody, okay, go ahead.
I'll ask that one, or I'll address that one first. And that kind of takes my advocacy hat off, and now I'm talking as a teacher educator. I think it's always better to have, you know, certifications. And I think most districts, when you ask them, they want maximum flexibility, and that flexibility is being able to do both health education and physical education. I think they, even though we see them as two distinct content areas, they see them as one position. And so if you have both licenses, you are in better shape. You know, the same thing with the adapted physical education endorsement. It's one more thing that you can add to the list. And again, there are multiple programs around the state that are offering health certification that you can dig into a bit, and it might be an opportunity. I think Pam mentioned alternative licensure might be a route to get there. And ODE is typically, their licensure office is your contact point for that question.
Somebody asked about taking the OAE health education licensure test.
I think alternative licensure, you can refer or you can contact ODE. And their licensure office can help you with that. But typically, any license is going to require you to complete the OAE in that content area. So if it's health education, you'll have to complete that test at some point and earn a passing score.
Okay.
So Any other questions, Tracy, as we?
Nope, we're good, thanks.
All right, so again, what I left up there while I was addressing that question was just kind of, these are the five tenets of the whole child. And again, I think all of the work that we do and actually the work of everybody in the school is targeting these five big outcomes, which is kids are healthy, safe, engaged, supported, and challenged. And again, they're at the forefront of our return to school plans. Whether you're online, in person, or hybrid, you're asking whether or not we've met these five things. And so I think you learning to communicate through these five tenets and also checking to see that, you know, what role does health education and physical education play not only in healthy students, but how do we create engagement and how do we make sure that they're supported? And it is part of the whole school piece. And so we are an essential part of a back to school plan. Transitioning to health education. And again, I'm not going to go through the whole slide piece by piece, but just to share with you some things that are going on within health education, physical education, and Ohio Revised Code, I want to share this piece. Many folks forget about what's our local curriculum, what's the prescribed curriculum, what's the difference between the two, and then what's the curriculum that I even teach back in my own classroom. So when I refer to, or when anybody refers to the prescribed curriculum is what the state requires you to do. And there are specific things that must be in your curriculum. Health education is much more specific than physical education, but health education has prescribed topics. Physical education has a prescription that it needs to be in every school's curriculum. And so the reason why this slide is really important and within our return to school plans is that the prescribed curriculum requires all the content areas that we would assume school is, but it also, the prescribed curriculum says health education and physical education must be a part of that prescribed curriculum. So it's not something that you can say, hey, since we're online, we're eliminating it. Or, hey, we don't have time anymore. When we went through that phase with lots of testing, folks were like, hey, they're trying to cut my program because they want to spend more time on this. It's part of the prescribed curriculum. And the prescribed curriculum, again, must be for each school under its control. So if you are a intermediate school, maybe grades 3 through 5, you have to have a health education, you have to have a physical education curriculum. And so knowing that this prescribed curriculum exists is a button you can push to say, we have to have this. It's not something that can be eliminated moving forward. And then we also have, outside of our prescribed curriculum, we have our graduation requirements. And most of you already know that a half credit in physical education is 120 hours and a half credit in health education is a minimum of 60 hours. Typically, that's one semester in health ed and that's two semesters in physical education. Other pieces for you to know, operating standards are how we deliver our curriculum. What those are basically standards or statements that are provided so that we can provide a high quality education. And so operating standards are how we go about our work. Prescribed curriculum is telling us what we have to have in there, what we must teach, so to speak, or the outcomes we must achieve. Operating standards are kind of how to deliver it. The main note from the operating standards, again, is that health and physical education are a part of our operating standards because we have to provide opportunities to learn. And that our instructional times are not required by law, but we must provide opportunities for students to acquire our outcomes. So that's an interesting statement, and it's interesting to eventually figure out how much time do we need to achieve our outcomes in physical education or in health education. And many people would debate how much time we need and whether, you know, one class a week is sufficient or 60 hours is enough. I don't know if that's a fight we can engage in, but that's, in terms of time, that is the one time requirement we can go back to and say, hey, in our operating standards, in our administrative code, it says I must have enough time to meet my local course of study objectives. So it's a minimum, not a maximum or not an ideal, but that is something that you could refer back to in law for opportunities within health education and physical education. Okay. Pause there for a second. Anything going on, Tracy?
Yeah. Our school currently only offers health education in high school. We did away with 7th and 8th grade health years ago. Is this allowed?
Based on what the prescribed curriculum is, if we go back to this slide, that if the statement is a curriculum for all schools under its control, the answer is you need to provide middle school curriculum for health education. Now, it doesn't say how much or how often, but it does say you must provide a curriculum and it must have these topics within it. I would say that the best course of action is to share that prescribed curriculum, those guidelines with your district officials and see where you get. They may be unaware that it's a requirement, but if you need additional support, we're happy to help along the way. And sometimes it is worth an email or a phone call just to ODE to get a clarification of what those prescribed guidelines are. But our interpretation is if it says for all schools, that would include middle school. And there are specific topics that must be addressed in grades K through 8. So I would agree that there are a lot of folks that are missing the boat on prescribed curriculum, especially in grades K through 5 for health education. But we've seen an expansion of the reduction of health education in the middle school levels. It's become a common occurrence to skip over those really important grades. And so really we get kids that are coming to high school for their one semester and that's it for health education when technically they're supposed to have it throughout. And that's something we've really tried to raise an awareness about, that we have these requirements and it's really tough when folks don't follow them.
Next question, this is a PE one. My district is eliminating high school physical education completely, and our students are supposed to get their credits in eighth grade through sports or band. Is something happening throughout Ohio?
Well, I can address that situation. So there's two ways to address this. Number one is be sure that the school is, again, prescribed curriculum says they must offer it at each school. So it needs to be offered whether or not kids take it or not. That's a bit of a challenge to debate there. The waiver piece, please make sure they're using the waiver in the way that it's prescribed by the state in terms of the local board must adopt the policy and they must meet the evidence, you know, within those other extracurricular activities. There's also a third piece to think about here is that whole advanced physical education credit. And so again, ODE has very specific information about advanced physical education. Again, if you're gonna give middle schoolers high school credit, they must complete the high school course. That would be true for health education also. One note about that is that folks always are like, so that high school content's too rich for our middle schoolers. And I'm like, well, then you probably shouldn't be offering high school credit to kids that aren't ready for it. They're not developmentally ready for it, so don't do it. But these are the guidelines. I cut and pasted this directly from ODE. So you have to make sure that they are receiving, again, the high school curriculum is the place to start. And technically, unless they waive out, you'll need high school physical education evaluation data for those kids who are getting high school credit. So start there with the conversation. I think there's different strategies to think about how to overcome the waiver. I think there's different strategies to think about this advanced credit piece. I know we're crunched for time. An interesting sidebar too is the substitution piece. The student is the one that actually selects. They're not required to sub out. And so I think that's a conversation you could have with administration and with your school counselors to say, how is the student making the choice and are we requiring them to, quote, opt out or waive out of that requirement? That's all. It's a really tough challenge, but I think if you start to have conversations with folks, that might be where I start. And just one other comment, Tracy, that the original intent of substitution and waiver, if you talk to state lawmakers, they did not realize that this is being used to support staff cuts or program cuts. Their intent was to create flexibility in the student's schedule. And so when you share it with state lawmakers, they're like, that isn't the intent. It was to create flexibility, not to eliminate educational opportunities for our students. And that's really the disappointing piece there is that they've taken away the option. So.
Another question. Would you know if high school health credit recovery can substitute the in-person health class?
I'm unsure of the definition of a health credit recovery. I'm guessing that's an additional health class. The requirement is just to again, complete that 60 hours that semester of a curriculum that is aligned with your district's curriculum. So I don't know enough about the recovery class to make a full comment on that, but I'm guessing that's an additional class that students might be repeating. And again, those outcomes should be reflective of the district's course of study in that class for it to count for the credit. Tracy, if you don't have another question, I'm going to just clarify real quick on the substitution piece, something that's related to when we go back to school a bit.
Okay.
Just a reminder that as we move back to school, physical education, and if you look there in credit flexibility plans might become more popular because I think a lot of our online asynchronous learning where students are meeting the course outcomes in an environment separate from our usual classes, whether it's online or face-to-face, our online asynchronous physical education courses are going to look a lot like credit flexibility. Remember that physical education is not just logging physical activity time, that we have specific standards. We have our physical education evaluation. Those are the indicators of physical education and of success, not logging 120 hours of physical activity. I've seen a couple instances of those pop up in my local area. So I want to remind people that logging hours is not class. The class and earning credit in the class is linked back to your learning outcomes, which are our standards and our evaluation. So please remember that. You can have them log. I think that's an important piece as to whether or not they're getting physical activity or not. But that is not the sole indicator of whether or not you have earned physical education credit. It's actually in your learning outcomes. So important clarification there that I just wanted to share. And again, because we usually get conversations about the substitution waiver policy, I just wanted to share that how to advocate for or against that, I think really comes down to most folks don't understand the difference between physical education and physical activity. You're probably not going to win the passionate argument about whether or not band or sports are physically active. They're going to win that argument because they are physically active during those activities. Where you do win the argument is the importance of what students are learning. And so are they learning? And you just go back to our standards and look at the evaluation and say, are these students learning this and this other alternative activity? And the answer is no. Then you just share that this is what they're missing. And is it okay to give that up? One other strategy that we've used, and it's been successful just one or two times, is that the waiver perpetuates negative stereotypes and diminishes the importance of physical activity. So one of the pieces that we share is that it diminishes our role, but it also diminishes the importance of physical activity moving forward. So share that. In the district, we said, hey, it hurts all of us when it's suggested that you can waive out of our subject area. It hurts our feelings. I think it's the words we exactly use to say, look, we feel diminished. And it perpetuates negative stereotypes, even to the kids that are in the class. And so when we do that, just be reminded of that and try to work cooperatively with your school counselors and your administrators to support kids that want to waive out, but yet say, hey, we'd love for them to be in there because they're going to achieve these outcomes. And I always suggest credit flexibility as an alternative because you always, kids will meet the outcomes, but they'll also get flexibility in their schedule. So. And I think always communicate with your counselors and administrators is going to be a key piece for that. Okay. Let's talk a little bit about health education. Or do we have a question? Sasha, have a question?
Sasha has a question. Should participation in band this year count for PE? I was told they are not having any band competitions as of now, and may or may not have halftime marching bands depending on schools and football games having possibly no spectators.
Brief conversations about this at the end of last school year, and I'm sharing this more as from a parent perspective. I had a spring sport athlete, and she's only a spring sport athlete. And the question was, hey, does whatever spring was, does that count as a season? And it was a district and student-to-student decision. So they were hoping that students were going to engage in other activities that they could wave out, so it wasn't a big deal. I am aware that they canceled marching band competitions and quote, the season. Football isn't officially done yet. But I think the policy moving forward is if the events are canceled, they're going to try their best not to negatively impact students. And that would be my recommendation, too. These students and everybody's been through a lot. And so I don't think it's a mountain to climb to fight for, to be like, hey, your marching band season was canceled, so make sure you sign up for physical education. I just don't think that that's being a team player at this point, but that's my personal piece, just because so much is going on. And my hope is that we can encourage them, that they have time to then get into another extracurricular activity. I think if you do want to climb that mountain, I think you're going to then talk about credit flexibility and having those students complete a credit flexibility plan so they are protected in case the seasons cancel and then they have enough credits to graduate. So I think I would push that. But for the most part, I'm on this one, I'm going to try to be a team player so it doesn't negatively impact the student. On the health education side of things, obviously, I can give you a quick legislation update. I'm going to flip through these slides real quick. You can, again, view the video to get the intimate details about all the health education requirements in the state. And we mentioned that many folks are not following the K-8 recommendations of meeting these topics. And again, there might be additional topics added to the list. There is a bill on the floor now to reinforce sexual abuse prevention. In addition to child abuse prevention, they would add sexual abuse prevention, and also suicide prevention would be added to high school. Both of those bills are in committee, haven't been voted out yet, but there is still more to be added to that list. We are working as hard as we can to continue to push for Senate Bill 121 still has a fighting chance of making it out by the end of the legislative session in December. Things are a little bit sidetracked right now. They're on summer recess, and then they'll come back to do elections in November. So we don't see a whole lot of action coming out of the Senate Education Committee to move that bill forward. But we're trying to fight in the background, so to speak, and advocate in the background. So when we do come back, we might be able to move quickly in what's called lame duck session, that time between the election and the new Senate and House coming into play. And we have an outside chance of getting it done, but we'll see. So the Senate Education Committee, they've had, I think our last hearing was the fifth hearing on that bill in June. And there might be a few more. It seems like we have probably the minimum number of votes for it to pass out of committee, but I need additional support. And so what we might do is call on us to have kind of a mini speak out day or a virtual speak out day where we're calling and emailing our senators to make sure that they're going to push for a vote in Senate Education Committee when they return to session. But we're getting closer, but I don't know as if we'll be close enough to the finish line by the time of session, and then we'd have to start this process all over again. But we're getting there. And some of the issues that have traditionally come up have not come up as late. So I feel more confident, but I don't know if we can get it done in the time that we have available. So any additional questions, Tracy?
Not so far.
Okay. And again, I know we've talked, I mentioned briefly that being an advocate is what you do every day. If some of you are interested in how do we support health and physical education legislation, I think building a relationship with your representatives, and I don't know if Lisa wants to chime in later, but one of the things that we learned through our speak out day is that many of our state representatives and state senators are unaware of what physical education and health education might actually be. Some of them went to school a number of years ago, and that is an outdated approach to both health education and physical education. And so it's never a bad thing to call, write, or use your social media connections to let folks know what you're doing. You're doing really awesome things, actually awesome things that they don't know how awesome they are. So we need to be able to tell our story to them, whether that's just, you know, sharing an email, sharing a news story or using your social media connections to let them know and to invite them in to see what's going on. Even as we return to school, I think it's going to be really important to share with them how we're doing and what we're doing, because they are providing their support, resources, et cetera, to help us be successful. And so let them know your efforts. And I will tell you across the board that folks are really, really interested in supporting healthy kids. So.
Jennifer has a question for you.
Yeah. Okay.
Hi, can you hear me?
Yes.
Okay, good. We had some mute problems earlier. So I am not an educator. I'm a partner with Oford, with the Dairy Association, and we are advocates for PE and physical activity in the schools. So how can we, or what resources could we help provide? I can't help with legislation, but I can help with your day-to-day. So are there resources you guys are looking for that we could help provide support or, you know, create for you guys for the distance learning issues and barriers that you have?
And I think the distance learning piece, we'll have a greater conversation about that on Monday and what resources we might need. I think early on, I'm still waiting to hear back from a lot of folks in terms of needs and opportunities. So I'll be curious. I don't think I know the answer to that question. I probably don't want to speak for everybody in the room. I think we always need help and support. But it's also been a challenge from a guidance perspective to know what we plan today is probably going to be replanned tomorrow. So that's kind of where we're at. I don't know any specifics right now, and it'll be interesting on Monday, next Monday, when we hear a little bit more from folks.
So can I ask, we have virtual dairy tours available, which do incorporate, you know, huge amounts of health messages. Is that something that is valuable to you guys as a resource?
It could be. And I think that's where, you know, I think sharing resources is an important piece, but the inclusion in the curriculum is going to be that local decision. And what we're trying to do is to help folks generate plans based on if we are in person, if we are online, or if we are in hybrid. And so those pieces will be part of that whole child effort as we move forward. So.
Okay, I'll be patient and wait until Monday. Thank you for your time.
Yep, and I apologize for the background noise. We are getting blasted by a storm right now, so.
That's okay, I was just trying to get my dogs not to bark at the mailman, I get it.
Okay, Kevin, and a different question. Why are we still using the term venereal disease instead of sexually transmitted infections as the medical professions are using?
Okay, so a good question. And this is a question we always get, and it actually gets people fired up about our issue of health standards real quick. Venereal disease is a term that was written into law back in the early 1990s. And by the way, if anybody follows national politics, the state representative at the time responsible for that is Representative Jim Jordan. So you can attribute that to him, but that is a term that's in legislation. So I can't change it. I'm repeating what was in legislation. I don't like to use the term. No one likes to use the term, but we have to use it because it's written in legislation. And so we've had conversations about changing that term. But we are not going to try to change that term within our health education standards legislation, because folks think that we are trying to change the existing law in terms of what are the requirements for abstinence only. So we're trying to narrow the topic just to standards. But someday we would like folks to change that terminology. And it may, we've had discussions in Senate education. It may be an amendment that they will put in to update that language. But it's also a very charged term. So if folks can't agree on it, it'll probably stay the way that it is, even though we're all annoyed by it. So we would prefer you to use correct and up-to-date contemporary terminology. And we always apologize when there is outdated terminology and legislation. So.
Just to clarify, as a currently licensed physical education teacher teaching elementary school, I can teach the health curriculum without an additional health certification.
Again, there's some clarification that you need within that. So are you talking about the K-5? You know, there's, I think if you have follow-up questions, I think ODE is a great place to go to ask those licensure questions after you have a conversation with your local district and your local administrator. So again, depending on what you're doing, there are different ways to answer that question. And it's more complex than a just yes or no. You know, it depends on if you're on the path to alternative licensure. It depends on a lot of different things moving forward. And this year is different than any other year. You know, there was some legislation that went through that made districts be a little bit more flexible on how they assign teachers and licenses. So it's not a question that I feel comfortable answering yes or no, but to have additional conversations with your district folks and then follow up with ODE and licensure if you have questions.
Okay.
I think we're almost up on time, right, Tracy?
5 minutes.
Okay. So you still have time to ask questions. You have 5 more minutes to ask questions, but as we kind of wrap up today, and it's the wrap up to the video online, just to remind you what advocacy is. Advocacy isn't going to the state house. Advocacy is educating and raising awareness. It's creating change, it's building a movement. And everybody that's on this presentation today can be an advocate. That advocate might be for your health and physical education curriculum. It might be for healthy students, but we can all be advocates. And so remember that your main job is actually the job that you do a lot, which is to educate. So think about that. The other piece is to think about compromise or solutions to issues. It might not always be, you might not always win. And I dedicate this train of thought to my mentor and partner in crime, Steve Mitchell, back in the day when we were advocating, they wanted to expand the waiver to include club sports. And we sat in the room and we're like, we may lose this, but we're going to find a way to win even while we're losing. And so I think that's where compromise comes into play or a solution. And in that situation, we're like, sure, if you want to expand the club sports, go ahead. But everybody that does the waiver has to do the evaluation. Well, eventually somebody got smart enough and read what we were up to. And they said, we know what you're doing. We kind of like it. The bill eventually died, but I want you to have the perspective of thinking about a compromise or a solution, even in a situation where you might not be happy with the essential outcome. If we think about the waiver, okay, the waiver is going to be there to stay. How do I benefit my students and myself the best? It might be to advocate for a credit flexibility stand, or it might be just to say, hey, counselors, when we go through and we have our initial sport or band meeting, you're not requiring kids to waive out. You can have them see me after if you need to sign a waiver for physical education. And just remember that advocacy is a daily activity. It's not something that we do once or twice a year. It's something we do all the time. So just remember that, that we're always advocates in it. And again, it's not a visit to the state house. It's not an email to a representative. It's doing your job. If you do your job, it's easier for us to actually advocate to everyone else. And doing our job means students are healthy and happy. So with that, I'm happy to take any additional questions. But again, if you have questions or concerns, I think OFERT is here to help and act as an advocate for you. ODE is really helpful in clarifying, and Randy's great at contacting her for clarification of requirements or assistance with the waiver or credit flexibility or what happens moving forward. Health education is a little bit different. ODE has some resources for us. The General Assembly has oversight, so you will get some help from Randy. Just understand that ODE's scope of practice within health education is limited because of legislation. So they can't provide as much as they would like to, but they've been very helpful along the way. But I'm happy to provide assistance, Tracy, to just provide. And when we talk about technical support, it's more just having a conversation about what do I do in this situation, and we'll help you navigate those waters to advocate for your programs and your students along the way. So with that, I say thank you for the opportunity to share. Thanks for sharing your afternoon with me. It's good to see all of you, by the way. Mary, good to see you.
Hey, Kevy, Cubs win.
Lisa just added the link for the YouTube link for the advocacy presentation if you wanted to watch it again, or it might be even useful to share it with your colleagues and others. That's why we recorded it the first time, so that you can get to hear my voice and share it with others. But thanks, everyone. And please be an advocate. We'll probably contact you in the near future about helping us out as we start to navigate the waters of when they come back to session. If we have a chance to do health standards, our best shot is in November. So we'll try. All right, Tracy, is there anything you need to do to wrap things up, or are we?
I think we're good.
Okay.
Good to go.
We'll see all of you next week.
Wednesday.
Oh, well, Wednesday, but yes,